sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about, oh my gosh, Acorn stole another election. Yeah, the group that's been gone for years and years, somehow, magically, mythically, from the beyond, they have come and they have stolen their second straight election, a group that does not exist. But they have done it, or so the GOP will have you believe. Also, another Republican privatization scheme in the works. This time, the lottery on the chopping block. Look out for pensions. They're coming, too. Also, Social Security and Medicare still in the GOP crosshairs, and worldwide Walmart. Yes, people from across the globe saying, you know what? You're leading us, well, down the hole. It's time to stop. It's time to hold the global corporate mega giant corporation accountable. And we'll talk about that. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I don't know if you've been watching all the big developments on the fiscal mirage as the economy is hurtling towards the nothing really. I mean, the cliff that they've created, you know, this, it's kind of anticlimactic when you actually tell the truth and say that, you know, as easily as they created this mirage, they can uncreate it. As easily as they created this crisis, this hostage situation, whatever you want to call it, whatever the phraseology you want to use, however they created this, they can uncreate it. But in playing with the theme, because hey, you know, it sells. There's a giant crisis coming, and we need to act. If we allow this to go over the cliff, it could be the end of civilization as we know it. The sky will fall. The earth will stop rotating. The air will stop being breathable. It'll just be over. It's all over. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed. I mean, it's gone from obscene to ridiculous to just plain freaking nuts. One of my favorite ones was Ted Nugent said, well, you know, any budget deal that we do, those welfare people, they shouldn't have voting rights. And I go, well, which welfare people are we talking about, Ted? Are we talking about the welfare people like, oh, I don't know, the largest welfare recipient in the country, Walmart? Should the people who have benefited wildly off of government largesse through social programs by cheating their workers, should we not allow them to vote? Would you stand for that, Ted? Huh? And the answer is no, because he's bought and paid for by that class. He's their little puppet. He thinks, oh, I'm a big gun guy. But at the end of the day, he's the puppet. Pointing his finger at people who can't defend themselves. And unlike any bully, that's what they do. Pick on the people who are unable to stand up and defend themselves. And I've got no respect for that whatsoever. But you look at this, and I mean, that's just one of that's the freaking nuts part of it. There's just some plain ridiculous stuff like pushing Medicare off and recalculating Social Security. And then there's the obscene where we want to take food out of the mouths of children. Yeah, I mean, we talked about the Republican plan yesterday that wanted to push off the Social Security age. I think it was 69. Because for me, it's 67. When I get to that, I'll have to be 67 to get to the end of the road. So what they're going to want for my kids and maybe it'd be 69, so we're pushing it off for everyone else. And then, of course, they found the revenue fairy, $800 billion in new revenue, because they absolutely refuse, under any condition, the Republicans, to raise the taxes of the very, very wealthy. The people have done really extraordinarily well, especially since the collapse that Wall Street and the financiers, yeah, that little thing that they created back in 2008 that cost us a couple million jobs, remember that? And growth in our economy, and let's not forget that 200.5 that used to be a 401k. Remember that? We can't tax those people. No. So we're going to close loopholes, but they won't say which ones. And I can tell you which ones. It doesn't take a genius to see the Republican mindset. Screw the working people. Screw the people at the bottom because they don't make contributions to their campaigns. $800 billion in new revenue. Where's it coming from? Nobody knows. And I've just told you, it's going to come from the home mortgage deduction. They're going to take some of that. Health care, that's probably going to get whacked off on the block. Let's not forget the child tax credit. Let's not forget the earned income tax credit. Let's not forget that. Those are gone. But we're going to make sure that we keep those corporate loopholes wide open, because those are the job craters. They also want to cut spending. So that, you know, the Republicans have taken this, well, what we need to do is we need to cut spending. Not thinking that, you know what, a lot of that spending is actually creating jobs. So when you're cutting those streamlines, you're cutting those jobs and you're causing more unemployment and causing less revenue to come in. You know, it's just kind of common sense that they've completely forgotten. But they're going to go after health care and other mandatory spending, about $900 billion. They're going to cut discretionary spending, about $300 billion. You know, food stamps for those lazy people. You know, like those workers at Walmart, cutting the food stamps. And they're also going to, they're going to change the, and I love how they put it, we're going to raise revenue by changing the cost of living adjustments for Social Security and Medicare. Basically, you're going to steal food out of my grandmother's mouth. I mean, that's what's happening. So we're going to steal food from the mouths of children, and granny, you're on the chopping block, so get ready to go after the cat food in the store. So start clipping your coupons now. So the Democrats came out with another plan. Obama came out with his. The Republicans said, oh, I'm flabbergasted. Can't imagine where he ever thought of such a thing, even though, you know, for a year he campaigned on it. But, you know, it's amazing. I never thought of such a thing. Who knew? Everybody. In fact, you know, I love the one show. One of the talking heads on TV said, well, I've seen some polling that suggests the American people want to raise taxes on the wealthy. I go, yeah, there was a Tuesday, first one there in November. There was a pretty sizable poll, if you remember. Pretty sizable one that said, Obama over the other guy. Pretty sizable poll that actually increased the Senate for the Democrats. Pretty sizable poll, if you remember. And in fact, some of the exit polling that came out of it, 60% of the people that were polled, raise taxes on the wealthy before you cut Social Security. Yeah, I mean, there's some poll, I just don't know which one it could have possibly been. And I love how they it's kind of funny. Anyway, a couple of Democrats came out with another plan. Former Treasury Secretaries Bob Rubin and Larry Summers, and look, at the end of the day, not a huge fan of either one of them, but their plan a little bit better than the Republican plan. Their plan would reduce the deficit if that's one of your main concerns. It's not my main concern, nor should it be the main concern of the nation. What the main concern of this nation should be is getting people back to work, getting the economy going. Getting taxpayers back to work. That should be the main focus of any plan right now to reduce our deficit. This is not the time to be going, oh, well, we're going to cut spending. We're going to cut, because the deficit is looming. You know what's causing the deficit? Nobody having jobs. You know what's causing our massive deficits? Not having people who have disposable income. There's an idea. You know why we have such huge deficits and such huge problems with spending? I'll tell you why. Because we're giving too much to the too few at the very top who aren't doing what we were told they were going to do. Where are the jobs? Oh, yeah, China, India, Vietnam. Yeah, that's where they are. Anyway, Rubin and Summers, along with Podesta, they laid out their plan. These are the Clinton people. They want to go back to the Clinton rate, 39.6 top marginal tax rate, up from the 35. But they're going to move it up from Obama's individual $200,000 up to $422,000. So they just bumped it up a little bit. They say that they're going to change the capital gains, which I'm all in favor of. They're going to move it from 15% up to 28%. I'm all in favor of that. Personally, I think it should just go right up with any income, but 28 is much better than 15, and it's much better than the 20 that Obama wanted. Dividends, they would change from the 15 rate that it is now up to ordinary income, which it has been historically. This was one of those Bush changes. Thanks a lot. They're going to allow for the repeal of the alternative minimum tax, though. Personally, I'm a fan of the Buffett rule, but here we go. They're going to repeal the carried interest so that you've got these investment fund managers who are changing their income into capital gains so that they don't have to pay the normal tax rates. Doing away with that. Also going to be replacing some of the itemized deductions. I'm telling you, the mortgage interest deduction, that's on there, along with a couple other things. The deductions for charitable giving would be as high as 28%. They say that households with less than $100,000 in income under their plan, under the Reuben Summers plan, would see no tax increases. People from the 100 to 500, a little bit, just a touch. And people with incomes over $1 million would see about a 5% increase from their current tax liability. And they claim that this is going to help close our deficit and end some of our problems. We shall see. There are a lot of things in here that let's wait and see till the details are fleshed out. I'm still hoping, to me, that the 28%, that's a huge one. I would love to see a transaction tax at some point. I would love to see a lot of things at some point so that we don't. My big concern is that we're going to allow the Republicans to do their cut and punish thing. That we're going to move towards more privatization, more vouchers, more of the things that have gotten us into the trouble we're in now. And I have some hope that the Democrats are ready and willing to go right to the mat with this, because they're on the right side of this. And we need to be telling them, look, before you go pushing off Social Security, before you go pushing off Medicare, before you go taking food out of the mouths of children and our seniors, those who are doing wildly well, the first club should be, okay, those who have done so well, they should be seeing their taxes go up just a little bit. I mean, going back to the Clinton tax, sorry, that is not a huge leap. That is not a heavy lift. That should be the common sense piece that, okay, that's something we can agree on. But they're going to hold the rest of us. The Republicans are going to hold the rest of us hostage solely for that 2%. Because the Republicans will tell you, we care. We care about the 98% of the time. We agree that it should all be extended. And my question is, if you agree with that, then why don't we just do that, end this whole thing right now, and you can argue all you want over the other one. It expires at the end of the year. If you do nothing, you come up with no agreement, it just goes up, and you go, hey, I didn't have a choice. And I didn't vote to raise the taxes, and I can hold my Grover pledge, and no one can hold me. People will hold me harmless. That's what the Republican plan probably is at some point. They're just going to let the taxes go up and say, well, I didn't raise taxes. It just happened. But in the process, what you're going to do is you're going to harm the economy by doing nothing. Because unemployment benefits are going to end, which means millions of people in this country are going to go without a paycheck and an ability to keep a roof over their head and food on the table. And, oh, by the way, money in the economy. Because understand, you need to have that money in the economy to have that reverberation effect, you know, that thing that creates jobs, that demand, something we used to understand. But you're going to need that. And if it ends, we got really real problems. And I'll tell you, before we take a break, one of the things that gives me hope, 4 conservatives got booted off of committees today. 2 of the most conservative Republicans in the House kicked off the House Budget Committee. A guy from Kansas and a guy from Michigan, both T-twits. Gone. Done. Goodbye. Why? Because they were going to say no to any, even if it was the most rational tax increase possible, even if they got 10-1. Spending cuts to tax increases, they were going to say no. So that gives me hope that Boehner's looking to cut a deal, looking to do what's right to making sure that we don't go over their cliff, that we don't have that thing that they've created, all that negativity, all that bad stuff happened that they created so that they would do their job. I mean, think about how twisted that is. We're going to have this horrible situation. We've created a horrible situation to make us do our job. It's insane. Gonna take a quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, alright. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. With budget talks stalemated for now in Washington, President Obama holding the line, insisting on tax increases for the top 2%, economist Dean Baker is urging people to calm down about the so-called fiscal cliff.
A lot of people in Washington are really trying to hype it. You know, certainly the term itself, fiscal cliff, you know, we're going to fall off the edge. It's almost impossible to imagine a scenario come, you know, whether it's January 5th, January 10th, you don't see a deal pretty quickly between the president and Congress. They get tax rates back down to the current levels for the rest of us. And, you know, for the top 2%, that's what we had the election over. They're going to pay higher taxes.
Baker says Social Security is fine far into the future, while raising the cap on income subject to the Social Security tax would close any funding gaps in decades to come. He says Medicare can be sustained, but we have to bring health care costs down. And he says raising wages while narrowing income inequality would go a long way toward fixing budget imbalances.
Now, over a long term, we should be seeing wage growth. The longer term problem, certainly, you know, the fact that the winners, the beneficiaries of economic growth have been almost exclusively those at the top end over the last three decades, that's a really big deal. I mean, that's created the sort of imbalances that got us into this.
Walmart could make a massive contribution to the U.S. economy simply by giving its workers a small wage increase. Jesse Russell reports.
Increasing the wages of workers who earn $21,000 on average per year to $25,000 per year would lift 700,000 Americans above the poverty line. That's according to a study released by the think tank Demos, which focused specifically on the low wages of the retail sector. The study shows that giving what amounts to a 27% raise to workers at companies which employ 1,000 workers or more would have a ripple effect impacting more than 5 million retail workers and their families. Nearly 770,000 workers currently just above the poverty line would see their incomes rise 150% above that line. According to Demos, such an increase would see the GDP rise by between $11.8 billion and $15.2 billion next year. The overall growth from increased spending power would allow for the creation of an additional 100,000 to 132,000 jobs.
The Coalition Against Segregation of Temporary Employees, CAST, is filing a class action discrimination suit in Chicago today, alleging that Johnson & Johnson supplier, VPAC, Inc., is systematically discriminating against African Americans in temporary agency hiring. After they file the suit, activists will inform shoppers at the Chicago-Austin Walmart about the alleged discrimination. Supporting actions are also being held by worker activists today in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and in Los Angeles. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
One of my favorites. You know, Pennsylvania embraces free markets. You look at all the money that we're handing away, and the latest in the privatization schemes that we're seeing and the big handouts that we're seeing. You know, it started with the cracker plant that they were going to build there anyway. I mean, there's no one going to tell me that they weren't going to build in that area. It may not have been that exact spot, but they were going to build in that area. $1.7 billion. Over the next 25 years. So think about the governors in the future looking back and going, wow, this Corbett guy who I don't even know who he was, he's really stuck it to us. And now you look at this scheme, to privatize the lottery system that we've got. Understand, the lottery system here in this country is, well, it's designed to help seniors. We hear this a lot. A lot of states, in Ohio, it's for education. In other states, it's, for social services or who knows what. And you look at this whole privatization. And I ask the question, and I do ask this quite often. Someone show me a privatization scheme that has benefited us, we the people. And no one ever comes up with one. And later when we talk to Mike Consul from the Roosevelt Institute, I'm going to ask that very question of him because, maybe he's got an idea. Because I've yet to find one. And I look at this lottery thing. I mean, the wine and spirit shop just blew my mind. If you remember, before we get into the lottery, if you remember the whole argument for the wine and spirit shops, this asset that you and I, the shareholders of the state of the Commonwealth, this asset that we own that pays a pretty good chunk of money in taxes that we don't have to pay, they wanted to hock that off. And originally said, oh, we'll get $2 billion for it. And then real quick, everyone goes, $2 billion, really? Can you show us any fact on that? Or did you just reach around behind and look to the dark side of the moon and pop out a number? And it turns out they reached, you know, got a good handful back there and, you know, and popped out a good number. Like most made-up facts and made-up numbers on the, right on the, off the cuff. Just pulled out of the, you know, the dark side of the moon there. Where their heads usually are. So quickly, $2 billion, they started walking away from. No, it was $1.7. Remember the $1.7 billion? And then quickly they kept going down, 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 until eventually it became, we have no idea how much money we're going to get out of this. And in fact, if you look to other states, it wasn't going to be hardly anything at all. Then the argument changed from, we can get this money to fill our budget gap, to core function of government. And you got to love how the Republicans can stop on a dime and change directions and well, wave that shiny thing. Over here, stupid! You know, it's like the little shiny little watch that puts you to sleep. So then it was core function of government. We don't think that the government should be in the wine and spirit shops. And I got to be honest, you can make the argument one way or the other. But originally you said it was about the money. Now it's about this. Isn't it really just about your ideology and your hatred of anything held by we the people? And the answer to that is absolutely. And the love of profit for a few. So quickly, the people in the Commonwealth said, you know what? We don't really want all of the ills that we see in other states that have privatized their liquor operations. And I go back to my hometown of Cleveland. Where just we were just back home for a little bit, and I walked into a gas station, pumped, and my credit card didn't work in the machine, so I walked into the rare I have to do that, but I walked into the station and paid with my credit card there, and hey, there was an entire display of a nice cooler with cold cans of cold beer right there, and yes, I succumbed to that impulse buy, and I bought myself a single solitary can of beer to take back to my hotel room. Question then becomes, is that what we want here in this state? Do we want to have the big display of wine or the big display of 42-proof vodka or whatever like they had in those places? And the answer, to I believe, is no. And quickly, the people said, we don't want that. And it's kind of died. Understand it's coming back. That whole push to privatize that will be back because they don't have any solutions to solve our job problems. So it's about selling off assets. Whatever it is that we have, we're going to sell off. It's like selling your furniture to pay the rent. That's basically what they're doing. Selling off everything they can to continue to pay the rent. Just so they don't have to bring in more revenue. You want to talk about lazy. You want to talk about shiftless. I think right there is a perfect example of, you want to talk welfare queen, right there. But it just doesn't stop with the wine and spirit shops. Now the next target is privatizing the lottery. And I think Frank Dermody said it best. You know, he said, now when no one in the General Assembly is in session, Governor Corbett is trying to hand deliver a lucrative contract to the lone bidder with no hearings, no legislative approval, and no public scrutiny, he said, and I absolutely agree, the whole thing stinks. Because if you remember, on the 20th of November, Corbett came out and said he was considering a bid, the only bid, from Camelot Global Services PA LLC. The Canadian-based company was the only bidder. They also operate the National Lottery of the United Kingdom. So you could make the argument, well, they know how. I would argue they know how to profit from the lottery system that they operate. And you look at some of the details, and we went through some of them. They said, well, it's going to It's going to level out the money that comes into the state because they're going to have to put up $150 million up front to make sure that, you know, when things dip down, you know, like in 2008 because we had that whole collapse, that there'll be, you know, even funding. And I go, well, couldn't we just take $150 million and put it into a fund and make sure that it's there? Oh, don't talk about that. I'll talk about having a savings, a rainy day. No, we can't possibly do that for ourselves. We need a for-profit company to do it, Rick. Come on, you know better. Yeah. What they didn't tell us in all of this, because, well, the devil is always in the details. What they didn't tell us is that the agreement, this privatization scheme, would require us, we, the citizens of this Commonwealth, to make sure that the operating expenses of the company were paid. That includes salaries, that includes CEO pay, that includes bonuses. That's in addition to their management fee, of course, which cuts into the profit. You know, the understand, what when we're talking about lottery profits, we're talking about programs for seniors in this state. Because we believe that the best way to take care of senior citizens in the Commonwealth, and, you know, the good God-fearing Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the year of the Bible this year, obviously, the best way we take care of those vulnerable folks, the people who are at the end of their lives, who are, you know, just trying to make it to the end, the best way to take it is through gambling, through people standing in line and buying lottery tickets. And when they don't have the disposable income, I guess grandma just suffers, right? Because we don't think enough to actually do dedicated funding. But under this contract, the guarantee will be that the company, well, that they're well taken care of. Now, as one of the only bidders, because they're the really the sole bidder, there were some people who showed interest, but I don't, from the information that I had, there were no other bidders. So, obviously, if you're the only bidder, you're going to lowball where you can. And apparently, according to the House Democrats, they have lowballed their performance targets, which, surprise, surprise. And as years go on, those targets are lower and lower. And the guarantee growth of the lottery over the years gets lower and lower until after 10 years, well, it's 1% growth per year, which it's been much more than that for the last 20. So when you look at this, you go, well, where, Rick, does the rest of that money go? Oh, yeah. Because understand, a private for-profit company is not going to put up $150 million. They're not going to gamble that money to ensure that there's level funding unless they're going to make a ton of money in return. Because one of the things that stuck with me when I interviewed Donna Cooper, who was was in the cabinet when Rendell was governor, because there was some talk, and again, I was against it when Rendell was proposing hocking off the turnpike. One of the things that stuck with me from my interview with Donna Cooper, well, she said, you know, the Wall Street people, the people who were going to do that deal, who were going to lease the turnpike for that 99-year period, what they wanted to ensure, what they wanted the Commonwealth to guarantee, and this just blew my mind because we keep hearing the right talk about, but Rick, we need to make sure that the low tax rates are lower. We need to make sure that they get tax breaks and there are loopholes for them because they're taking risks. Right? I mean, isn't that the argument for people who invest? It's risk-taking. We need to incentivize the risk-takers because if there's no incentive, the risk-takers won't take risks. And if they don't do that, there won't be entrepreneurs. And if there are no entrepreneurs, there are no jobs. Isn't that what they spell? Come on. You're right there, right? Well, what Donna Cooper said is in the negotiations when they're talking about leasing the turnpike for 75 years, she said, you know, the people on Wall Street, the financiers, they wanted to be guaranteed profits for those 99 years, and not just profits. The profits, and it goes back to opportunity costs, the profits that they would have otherwise gained in any other investment that they could imagine, or where they would have used that money anywhere else, they wanted to guarantee at least that. And I'm going, well, how do people like you and me and how do working people get that kind of a deal? How do I get that kind of, because I'll gladly put up all the money I have to make sure that in 20 and 30 years that I'm going to be guaranteed as much return as I would have done on my best possible deal anywhere else, that the opportunity cost would be, well, it would be actualized. Well, you and I don't get that, obviously. But the big global corporations, the wealth class, does. And who ends up suffering? In this gig, it's going to be the seniors. It's going to be those programs that are funded through this lottery. And what's interesting to me, as the House Democrats point out, Corbett has said that annual profits of the lottery are guaranteed. But it doesn't require Camelot to pay seniors the difference between actual results and its projections. They may pay some of the difference, but it's not going to be all. And according to the report that I saw, in Illinois, where they have a private lottery manager like they're talking about here, the state, their financial penalties for falling short of the projected goal in court, because the company that's doing this is challenging the state's ability to do that, even though they agreed to it in the contract. And guess what's going to happen out of that? Well, the state of Illinois is going to have to pay more in legal costs. It's going to cost taxpayers more money. And if this big company can draw that out longer and longer and longer down the road, there'll be no incentive to hold them accountable. Because, of course, we all do cost-benefit analysis. And if going after the company that's cheating you costs you more money than it would to get what you're going to stop doing it. So again, you and I, we're the ones who get screwed. And one of my favorite parts of all this is there is an automatic contract extension if the company wants it. So the 20-year stated term could be 30 if the company wants it. No legislative action, no public input, no voice by you and me, no way to hold anyone accountable for up to 30 years. Think about that. This guy, Tom Corbett's going to be out in 2 years. I mark my word. He has done enough. He has been destructive enough to this Commonwealth that I think he's done in 2 years. And he knows it. So we're going to see more of this stuff, which is why we need to be contacting our representatives, which is why we need to be getting involved in stopping this. Because this is a theft, not just from the taxpayers, but from my grandparents, from that generation, and the programs that are supposed to be helping them, since obviously we don't want to fund them. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this whole lottery scheme anyway, because, you know, the big lottery just came and went. We're going to talk a little bit more. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Gamley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GamleyLaw.com.
Born in 1930 in Schiller Park, Illinois, the deceased was 82 years old at the time of passing, the day before Thanksgiving. Having enjoyed the sweet life, the end was a bit bitter, for the estate of the dearly departed had been mercilessly plundered in recent years by unscrupulous money managers, leaving 18,500 surviving family members in dire straits. Indeed, the family contends the octogenarian's death was not due to natural causes, but to foul play. This is the drama behind the death of Twinkie, fondly remembered as the cream puff of the proletariat, and less fondly as a sugar and fat bomb that was a toothache in one bite and a heart attack in the next. This industrial concoction became an American icon. The father of the Twinkie was a baker at the Old Continental Baking Company. He saw the product as a way to keep the factory's confection machinery busy after strawberry shortcake season. Yes, the Twinkie was actually conceived as food for idle machines. How fitting is that? But us humans happily swallowed this extruded marvel of comestible engineering. The Twinkie was the bestseller of Hostess Brands, a conglomerate purveyor of some 30 nutritionally challenged brand-name foods, ranging from Wonder Bread to Ho-Ho's. In the past year, Hostess racked up $2.5 billion in sales. It suffered a staggering $1.1 billion in losses. Thus, Ripplewood Holdings, the private equity outfit that had taken over the conglomerate in 2009, solemnly announced that Hostess simply could not survive. Why? Because, executives said, the company's greedy labor unions would not take pay cuts to save it. This is Jim Hightower saying, wait a minute, the bereaved loved ones are to blame? Holy Agatha Christie, that can't be right. Tune in tomorrow for the real story of Who Killed the Twinkie?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Fox News alert, it's election day. We got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia.
From the new Black Panther Party, open the door for that little old lady. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that didn't make such good, compelling TV, did it, ding dong? It's amazing to me that they kept running it throughout the day, this angry-looking black guy opening a door for old people. Oh, that, well, I guess in conservative world, that is, well, that's, I don't even know where you go with that. I mean, the reality is they're looking for any way to keep us divided. Any way to make the minions that watch that idiocy buy into their frame. Oh, that guy who has no power, he's trying to steal the election. That guy who has no real power. Unlike the Senate Majority Leader here in Pennsylvania, a guy named Dominic Pileggi, who, if you remember, not too long ago was one of those folks who, with Corbett, floated the trial balloon on changing how electors were allocated. You know, here in Pennsylvania, which had 20 electoral votes, they wanted to allocate them a little differently, you know, by congressional district. So what you would have seen is out of the 20 electoral votes, 13 of them would have gone to Romney. The other 7 would have gone to Obama. Because what they wanted to do is the 18 congressional districts, one elector from each of there, and then the 2 for the Senate's, the statewide races. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Popular vote. And understand that's what's coming in 2016. But, you know, here's the thing. You listen to all of this talk on the fiscal mirage. And, you know, in looking at this lottery privatization scheme, Jeff Greenfield at Yahoo News had an interesting thought today. Why not capitalize on lotto fever? Why not set up a taxpayer lottery? I mean, because And one of the things that bothers me, and I think we hit on this a little bit earlier, one of the things that bothers me with the whole lottery setup, especially when you're talking about funding programs that we believe in, is that there hasn't been an awful lot of research done on what happens to the net proceeds from the $56 billion per year in lottery sales tickets that are supposed to go to education and seniors and you know, all that stuff. We haven't really examined if those are actually, well, wait a minute, we have actually. In fact, the folks at the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government, they found new gambling operations that are intended to pay for normal increases in general state spending. Well, they may actually add to rather than ease state budget imbalances. We have seen over the last several years states like Ohio that their money is supposed to go to education where education funded has fallen. And there have been numerous studies done that show that states who rely on these lotteries have actually seen their funding go down from states that actually allocate that funding to make sure that it's consistent. So one of my pet peeves is that we're funding granny. We're funding programs that help senior citizens off of gambling, off of people's disposable income habits. But Greenfield points out, he says, you know, people are standing in line, people are spending all this money. He points out, you know, Voltaire, who evidently said, you know, the lottery was a tax on stupidity. And I kind of agree because, you know, I've never bought a lottery ticket. I don't need that little daily fantasy. I know some people who do. I've got friends who they need that daily fantasy that, you won't see me on Monday if I win. I'll be off on the beach. And then they live in that world where, hey, if I won, and then the next day it's kind of a letdown, they lost. But they're expecting to lose anyway. But what Greenfield says is we need to set up a taxpayer lottery. And how he says to do it, save people the standing in line, because if you saw the lines for the big Powerball recently, people were in line for an hour. And it just blows my mind that, you know, that people are willing to stand in that kind of line to throw money away. Just for the chance to possibly maybe under one in a billion gonna win something. But Greenfield points out, he says, you know, what we need to do is we need to have a taxpayer lottery where everyone is automatically eligible. And you make the prizes anywhere from $50 million up to $1 billion. Lump sum, tax-free, you win, you get it. There's no entry fee, no ticket to buy, none of that stuff. All you have to do, and there'll be several hundred winners, there'll be some prizes there. All you have to do is pay your taxes. File your tax return. And, oh, by the way, your tax return will be audited. And understand, everybody's tax return will be audited, and we put the resources into, actually auditing them. Because according to Greenfield, in this country, tax evasion is about a $2 trillion a year business. Not tax avoidance, not the Romney doing the loopholes and the Caymans and all of that. This is actual illegal evasion, the kind that, you know, Al Capone got busted for. Couldn't get him on anything else, got him on tax evasion. That $2 trillion a year, what Greenfield says, represents about a federal loss of about $500 billion a year. And he says, you know, you make sure that this happens, and, you know, maybe people will pay their taxes, and maybe you have this game, and it'll be all wonderful. Now, understand, and Greenfield admits, you know, the idea that rich people aren't going to cheat on their taxes and are going to report their incomes honestly is not going to happen. There's very little that you can give them that's going to persuade them, because they're already rich. They don't need the $50,000. They don't need, you know, the little bit more that would come. And then you audit them anyway. But he says, you know, hey, you know, we need to, you know, maybe the lottery would be something that would get people interested. But here again, I'm not the gambling type. I'm of the mindset we should be auditing every tax filing. We should be demanding that people pay their share. And We should be making that, sure that it's not regressive taxes that are destroying our economy. And I look at the lottery system as a regressive tax on the poor, because those are the folks who generally are the ones buying those lottery tickets or standing in those lines. The working folks of this country. Instead of having a system where the bigger your shoulder, like we used to during the good socialist years of Eisenhower, where the bigger your shoulders, the more you carry. The more that our society has granted upon you, the more that is asked from you. We used to think that way, but things kind of changed. And those changes came with conservatism. This idea that government's bad, and they've really sold this idea. We need small government. I talked to a friend who said, well, I just want small government. I go, I don't. I want effective government. I don't care how what size it is. I want it to do its job. And he goes, well, yeah, that too. No. Not that too. That's what I want. I want to make sure the roads are paved. I want to make sure the kids get education. I want to make sure that my grandmother's in a place where she can be taken care of if we can't do it. I want to make sure that our communities are safe. And the sad reality is we're falling down on those jobs because we've got this tax cut fetish. This fetish of enriching the very, very wealthy at the expense of the rest of us. Because the reality is they can pay to have their communities patrolled with private police. They can pay to have their communities paved. They can pay to have private schools. They can pay to have private hospitals. They can pay to have private restaurants and clubs and airports and you name it. They can pay to have separate. And there's no separate but equal. There is separate and, well, you're on your own, brother. And that's what we've allowed to happen. And in fact, the sad reality is because they keep telling us, well, you can be one of us. You just have to work harder while we destroy labor unions and push down the minimum wage. Think about that. Because that's what they've sold us. And sadly, that's what many of us have bought. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
Today, Snowball Earth. It's a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, Earth was entirely covered by ice.
There's geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists haven't been able to agree on how an ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again. So they've never entirely accepted the Snowball Earth theory.
In late 2012, a team of scientists from the US, Germany, and France published a paper about how a snowball Earth might have begun to melt. They used a computer model, the same sort of model used to study global warming in our time, to examine the role of clouds above an Earth entirely covered with ice.
In modern studies of climate, clouds play a complex role. They reflect sunlight and so help cool the Earth. And they also trap sunlight and so help warm the Earth. That's why clouds are a challenge in studies of global warming.
But a snowball Earth would have already been highly reflective, so the reflectivity of clouds would be less important, these scientists say. They say clouds' primary role would have been to trap heat and so start melting the ice, thawing the snowball Earth, and leading eventually to the world we know today. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words snowball Earth. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, this whole fiscal mirage thing that they keep shoving down our throats and all the scary, spooky stuff. Oh, the end of the world's coming because we've created this crisis. What the real crisis is? The real crisis is jobs. And you go back today, 1943. President Roosevelt announced the end of the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was started. You know why? Well, it started to get people back to work. And in fact, in the four-year run, what it did is it created about 8.5 million jobs, put about 8.5 million people to work building roads and bridges and public buildings and all kinds of things that well, sadly, we're still using today that we haven't reinvested and upgraded. I say we need that again. We need that kind of investment. We need that kind of commitment. That's how you fix what ails this country, getting people back to work. And speaking of people back to work, last night we talked about Tricky Ricky Santorum's new gig as the conspiracy theory bloggist over at World Net Daily. Now we see Mittens has found a job. Yes, Mittens has got a board of directors position over at Marriott International. And I learned something today. Evidently, Mittens worked for Marriott International twice before, once from 1993 to 2011 when he went off to run for governor, and then from 2009 to 2011, or I mean 93 to 2002 when he went off to run for governor, and then 2009 to 2011 when he decided that he was going to run for president. Nice little gig, and now he'll be there again. Nice little paycheck, I'm sure, help him afford that subterranean parking garage. What I learned was Romney has been connected to the Marriott dynasty his entire life. And, you know, you love to hear those rags to riches. You know, Mittens pulled himself up because, you know, all that. Turns out Mittens was actually named after J.W. Marriott. Because JW stands for John Willard. And Willard Mitt Romney, well, Willard. I always wondered where the Willard came from. It came from John Willard Marriott. Turns out John Willard Marriott was a close personal friend with George Romney, Mitten's father. And I go back to that, you know, that capital thing. That, you know, if you have financial capital or human capital or the secret capital of connections, you're probably going to do all right. I mean, you look at Donald Trump, people say, oh, look at him, he did all this. His father was a pretty powerful guy, too. A lot of connections. That when you're a younger guy, you got the ability to make phone calls. And, you know, you look at George W. Bush. Do you think he'd have been anything had his father not been president? I mean, really, stop and think about that for a second. And these are the people who are preaching to us about, well, you know, those lazy, greedy people. you know, those people with pensions. And here at home, we're going to be, here in Pennsylvania, we're going to be arguing about the pension issue. And the right loves to throw out those extremes. You know, there's a guy in New Jersey. There's a guy in New Jersey, a former police chief. He's got a pension of $147,000 a year. And there are other people who have $100,000 pensions. There's a guy in Massachusetts, the former vice chancellor for clinical affairs at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. You know, he's got a pension of $232,000. Is that right? And in New York, there's the guy who's the retired head of the New York Power Authority. You know, one of their executives, he's got a pension of $190,000 a year. And, oh, let's not forget about that guy, because California screwed up, too. There's the guy who was the head of the Modesto City School District. He was their superintendent. He gets $296,000 each and every year. And you go, yeah, I see a problem. There's a problem with that. Those handful of instances, sure. And address those. Why are we screwing with people who are making $18,000 to $24,000 a year on pension? That's who the Republicans in this state want to go after. Understand that. This whole push against pensions for public sector workers, they're going to try and divide us using a handful of extremes. And my favorite one, my favorite one is, do you know there are policemen and firefighters in New Jersey that they're going to collect $13.7 million in unused sick time? Do you know that? And I've had that thrown up to me. I go, well, what the hell has that got to do with pensions? Nothing. But it's a nice diversion, isn't it? It's a nice, hey, someone's getting something that we're not. And my question back to the guy who threw this at me was, well, how much pension time did you have last year? Well, I had 10 days. Or how many sick days did you have last year? I had 10 days. Could you use them? Well, yeah. I go, well, they didn't. And they were allowed to save them. If you want to change that, change that. But don't conflate it with anything having to do with pensions. We should be defending those people who are going to be losing their pensions and going to get screwed. And just because we in the private sector got screwed, we shouldn't be screwing those in the public sector. We should be going, hey, help us figure out how to get it back. Help us figure out how we get that kind of security. That's the kind of nation we need to return to. Not, hey, let's tear you apart, but hey, let's build all of us up. And again, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, the website for the podcast, Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher on the smartphone, right back after this with Hour 2. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. With budget talks stalemated for now in Washington, President Obama holding the line, insisting on tax increases for the top 2%, economist Dean Baker is urging people to calm down about the so-called fiscal cliff.
A lot of people in Washington are really trying to hype it. You know, certainly the term itself, fiscal cliff, you know, we're going to fall off the edge. But it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario come, you know, whether it's January 5th, January 10th, you don't see a deal pretty quickly between the president and Congress. They get tax rates back down to the current levels for the rest of us. And, you know, the top 2%, that's what we had the election over. They're going to pay higher taxes.
Baker says Social Security is fine far into the future, while raising the cap on income subject to the Social Security tax would close any funding gaps in decades to come. He says Medicare can be sustained, but we have to bring health care costs down. And he says raising wages while narrowing income inequality would go a long way toward fixing budget imbalances.
Over a long term, we should be seeing wage growth. The longer term problem, certainly, you know, the fact that the winners, the beneficiaries of economic growth have been almost exclusively those at the top end over the last three decades. That's a really big deal. I mean, that's created the sort of imbalances that got us into this.
Walmart could make a massive contribution to the U.S. economy simply by giving its workers a small wage increase. Jesse Russell reports.
Increasing the wages of workers who earn $21,000 on average per year to $25,000 per year would lift 700,000 Americans above the poverty line. That's according to a study released by the think tank Demos, which focused specifically on the low wages of the retail sector. The study shows that giving what amounts to a 27% raise to workers at companies which employ 1,000 workers or more would have a ripple effect impacting more than 5 million retail workers and their families. Nearly 770,000 workers currently just above the poverty line would see their incomes rise 150% above that line. According to Demos, such an increase would see the GDP rise by between $11.8 billion and $15.2 billion next year. The overall growth from increased spending power would allow for the creation of an additional 100,000 to 132,000 jobs.
The Coalition Against Segregation of Temporary Employees, CAST, is filing a class action discrimination suit in Chicago today, alleging that Johnson & Johnson supplier VPAC, Inc., is systematically discriminating against African Americans in temporary agency hiring. After they file the suit, activists will inform shoppers at the Chicago Austin Walmart about the alleged discrimination. Supporting actions are also being held by worker activists today in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and in Los Angeles.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
But the fact
Vice
is,
President Cheney, though, said it's not a Ponzi scheme. You say it is.
If Vice President Cheney or anyone else says that the program that we have in place today and young people who are paying into that expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age, that is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone says. We know that. The American people know that. But more importantly, those 25 and 30-year-olds know that.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of the Rick Smith Show program. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Honeywell CEO David Cote, who was at the Fix the Debt meeting. He said, quote, "Change CPI, raising eligibility age, and means testing should all be on the table." And I got to be honest, I'm glad to see that Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a member of the Senate Budget Committee, is going to be holding a press conference tomorrow at the National Press Club, highlighting the fact, addressing what's going on in these negotiations. Sanders is the founder of Defending Social Security Caucus. He has been strongly opposed to Simpson-Bowles, which is kind of what's being rammed down our throats, recently authoring a letter to Senate colleagues to oppose that plan. And I'm telling you, pushing Medicare off a few more years, recalculating Social Security and Medicare, I mean, stealing, it is what it is. You're basically stealing income from my grandmother under the guise of, we're saving it. We're saving Social Security and Medicare by, well, destroying it. Which is why I've asked Max Rittman. He is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education groups. Max, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you for inviting me tonight.
You know, I listened to CEO Cody's statement, you know, the change CPI, the eligibility age, means testing, all that on the table. What does that mean for my grandmother now? What's it mean for me and my kids in the future?
Well, some of those items you mentioned would apply immediately for not just in the future, not, you know, 20 years from now, but immediately. The chain CPI that you mentioned is a really tricky way to impose a smaller cost of living adjustment. And it's a new formula that has been devised that relies on some concepts of they call it substitution. In other words, if the price of something goes up, rather than factor that into inflation, you pick something that's cheaper. And there are limits to how that could work when it applies to not just Social Security, but veterans benefits, retired federal employees, disabled. But there's a lot of money to be had by doing that over time because the COLA, as your listeners know, is compounded. So it builds on itself.
Yep.
And by the same token, it's a lot of money out of people's pockets that they rely on.
So
this has been gaining some momentum and some traction, and I am deeply concerned about it.
I'm as well. You know, and looking at at Boehner's plan that they put out yesterday, the new revenue that they talk about, the $800 billion in closing loopholes, could this be part of, since they didn't tell us what it is, could this be part of it? The hundreds of billions of more in savings that they claim are going to come from this recalculating, basically stealing from my grandmother. This is all part of what they're talking about, correct?
This is part of the plan. It's called the chain CPI. What bothers so many of us that work in this area is that policymakers that support this device for reducing the COLA, they seem to think that they can sell it to seniors as a more accurate measure of inflation, and they think that somehow that will sell. It won't sell. You know, this year seniors got a COLA, this current 2012. They're getting a small one next year. But the previous 2 years there was zero COLA.
Right.
And that's based on a formula that is better. So in other words, if the formula, this chain CPI that's being talked about had been implemented in the two prior years where there was no COLA, I suppose the advocates of that chain CPI would have said that zero you got was too much.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at how they've tied, like Colorado, for instance, has done that with their minimum wage, where they actually took back some of the minimum wage. So I can see their conservatives saying, well, you know, if we're going to do that, we should take some of that Social Security money back. And as you've pointed out, harming not just my grandmother, but my future as well.
Absolutely right. You know, the other issue that is, unfortunately, I think it's going to be working its way through this process and has a lot of support, bipartisan support, is extending this payroll tax holiday. And for the last 2 years, there's been a reduction of 2 percentage points on the employee side for the FICA tax. And
right.
That was done temporarily to put money in people's pockets. And we didn't like it. I put out a statement passed and said there's no such thing as a temporary tax holiday, and then sure enough they extended it for another year, and now there's a lot of talk about extending it. Now we need to have things in the tax code that will spur the economy and keep us from sliding back into the recession, but there are other ways to do this. And the reason I was so concerned about it is now coming into a reality. What bothered us was if the payroll tax is cut and general revenues are used to replace it, which has been, thankfully, has happened the last 2 years, general revenues go in, that at some point the argument will be made, well, Social Security is not self-financed anymore. You need general revenues. And sure enough, as part of the Republican proposal, the discussion that came out yesterday, the discussion around it, contradicted those who have argued that the Social Security should not be part of this negotiation. It's self-financed, doesn't add to the deficit. Now the argument is being offered that, in fact, Social Security does count on general revenues, and it needed that general revenue to pay benefits for the last 2 years. That's only because there was a payroll tax holiday.
Right. And I got to be honest with you, though, Max. You know, when the president proposed it and they put it in the law, I thought at the time when we needed it, it was the best, most efficient way to get money into people's pockets. Unlike during the Bush years where they told us, hey, you're going to get your Bush prize. And they sent out a letter saying, hey, check your mailbox. The Bush prize is coming. And they sent out checks. And one of the most inefficient ways of getting money from an economy standpoint into people's hands, they pursued. Politically, it was the best way to do it for Bush and the Republicans because it looked like, hey, we're getting these gifts. And everyone knew they got their Bush prize. But if you look at the polling, most people didn't realize that they had more money in their paychecks when this happened, because this was, I believe, the most efficient way to get money in their pockets. But you're right. It's supposed to sunshine, and it should.
It should. And there really are other ways in the tax code. There's a provision that was talked about last year. I proposed it to the White House, and Republicans did not support it. It's a tax credit, make work pay tax credit, which which would put money back into people's pockets right away because your withholding would be reduced. So you'd have more money in your check, but you wouldn't be risking that concept of Social Security being self-financed, should not be part of the discussion now, is not in crisis, is not bankrupt, does not depend on general revenues. And that's where we're at now.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you 100% on that. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Max Rickman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Their website, ncpssm.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Max's name. It'll take you right there. If you looked at the election, Max, up until, you know, the president won re-election, the Republicans were claiming to be the saviors of Medicare. I remember Romney with his whiteboard and his marker showing how he was going to put back $716 billion that the president was stealing. And now I see Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee saying, well, you know what? We're going to have very painful cuts to Medicare. And I see a lot of people saying, well, you know, we got to scale that back now. We got to take money away. Boehner's plan, taking money out of it. You know, who do we buy? I mean, the Republicans pre-election were the saviors. Now post-election, well, we want painful cuts.
Yeah.
What's
going on? You know, I've seen a lot of hypocrisy. And when I worked on Capitol Hill for 16 years, I was staff director of two different committees in the Senate. And I've seen hypocrisy, but this takes it to a new level. A few weeks ago, as you say, in all these campaigns, not just the presidential, but all around the country, those people who supported and voted for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare were being hammered with the accusation that $716 billion were being cut for Medicare. In fact, what was done is savings out of provider reimbursements were realized, and a lot of those savings went back to improving the Medicare program, adding preventive care with no out-of-pocket cost, extending the solvency of the Medicare program by putting that money back in that was saved for 8 years. So all these attacks, and now all of a sudden, it seems to me most Republicans say we're not going to negotiate unless Medicare is cut.
Yep.
It's just, I tell you, it drives me crazy. It's such rank hypocrisy.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at this fiscal mirage is what I've been calling it, because they created it, they can uncreate it. This so-called cliff that they've created for us, they can undo this and do what's rational and sane. But I guess hostage situations and crisis, that sells.
Well, you know, we'll see how all that plays out.
Yeah. So let me ask you a couple of quick bang-bang questions. You know, the changes in the cost of the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, these are cuts to benefits, right?
Absolutely. You're getting less money than you would otherwise. I call it a cut.
Raising the retirement age is a cut in benefits, right?
Absolutely. During your retirement, you're going to get less in benefits. That's a cut.
The Simpson-Bowles plan that they're trying to ram down our throats, this is a cut to Social Security, right?
And Medicare. It would raise the age for Medicare Eligibility Institute, this chain CPI, reduce the formulas for lowering basic Social Security benefits. So any way, pardon the pun, any way you cut it, it's a cut.
Absolutely. So what do we do about it?
Well, I heard a little bit of your program of all the mobilizing that's going on. We are having a congressional call-in day tomorrow. We've sent, as I mentioned, we have 3.5 million members and supporters around the country. We've contacted as many as we could in the last week. And for your listeners, what we've told them is to call our 800 number, 966-1935, the year Social Security became law, and we will connect callers to their congressional office, their senators or their House of Representatives member. And make it clear, the message is hands off, no cuts. Hands off, no cuts. And we will hopefully flood these switchboards so the message will be loud and clear.
And it's going to have to be. I mean, we've got a senator in this state, Pat Toomey, who he's all in favor of, you know, hey, let's cut, gut, and punish. Let's slash and burn. And to me, it's the absolute wrong direction. And for the whole purpose being that they protect the tax cuts for the very, very wealthy, people who don't need it. So we're taking literally, I mean, if you look at the Boehner proposal, we are literally taking food out of the mouths of children and food out of the mouths of seniors to make sure the well-heeled are even more well-heeled.
Well, I don't know how they can go to sleep at night knowing that that's what they're all about, but they seem to be able to.
So, again, the website, ncpssm.org. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Tomorrow's National Call-In Day. Go to the website. More stuff there for you. We'll have some stuff at therickssmithshow.com. Max, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do. Thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate you having me on and giving me an opportunity to spread the word.
Anytime.
Max
Rickman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. They are one of the big influential groups in pushing and educating senior groups, saying, look, you know what? Any cutting, any of this whole changing the COLA, raising the retirement age, Simpson Bowles, these are all benefit cuts for working people. It's a bad idea. We should be going after the very wealthy first. First and foremost. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pfecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Born in 1930 in Schiller Park, Illinois, the deceased was 82 years old at the time of passing, the day before Thanksgiving. Having enjoyed the sweet life, the end was a bit bitter, for the estate of the dearly departed had been mercilessly plundered in recent years by unscrupulous money managers, leaving 18,500 surviving family members in dire straits. Indeed, the family contends that the octogenarian's death was not due to natural causes, but to foul play. This is the drama behind the death of Twinkies, fondly remembered as the cream puff of the proletariat, and less fondly as a sugar and fat bomb that was a toothache in one bite and a heart attack in the next. This industrial concoction became an American icon. The father of the Twinkie was a baker at the Old Continental Baking Company. He saw the product as a way to keep the factory's confection machinery busy after strawberry shortcake season. Yes, the Twinkie was actually conceived as food for idle machines. How fitting is that? But us humans happily swallowed this extruded marvel of comestible engineering. The Twinkie was the bestseller of Hostess Brands, a conglomerate purveyor of some 30 nutritionally challenged brand-name foods, ranging from Wonder Bread to Ho-Ho's. In the past year, Hostess racked up $2.5 billion in sales, yet it suffered a staggering $1.1 billion in losses. Thus, Ripplewood Holdings, the private equity outfit that had taken over the conglomerate in 2009, solemnly announced that Hostess simply could not survive. Why? Because, executives said, the company's greedy labor unions would not take pay cuts to save it. This is Jim Hightower saying, wait a minute, the bereaved loved ones are to blame? Holy Agatha Christie, that can't be right. Tune in tomorrow for the real story of Who Killed the Twinkie?
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
sent me an email. And again, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And he says, look, you know, the Republicans have always wanted to destroy Social Security and Medicare. Always. Why should anything be different? Nothing's changed. He says citizens have to realize the Republicans want these social programs eliminated. Always have, always will. Any other rhetoric to the contrary is just propaganda. And I absolutely agree with him. You know, the reality is these are the folks who are against it from the beginning. These are the folks who, and I want you to remember this. Tell your children. I'm telling my kids that this generation of Republicans were dead set against the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Dead set against it. And have worked tirelessly for at least, from the beginning, but at least the last 2 years to do everything they could possibly do to repeal it. And I want my kids to remember that. So in 20 and 30 years, 40 years down the road, when most of us have lost our minds and we're the amnesiac society that we're becoming, that hopefully they'll remember and go, you know what? They were against it much like they were against everything else that benefited working people. Because I'm telling you right now, the genesis of Obamacare, as we move we're gonna make it better. The tweaks are gonna happen. Things are gonna move in the direction of making it better once people realize, hey, you know, it's here to stay. We better get the best bang for our buck like we did with Medicare. And Medicare to me is the example. It didn't do a whole hell of a lot when it was put into law. And there were a lot of holes, a lot of cracks, a lot of people fell out of it. But you know what? Over time, we fixed it. And we demanded a little bit more. And we demanded to make sure that, you know, Granny's taken care of. And we demanded that the most vulnerable through Medicaid taken care of. If only we had thought. If only we had the idea that, you know what? Instead of taking care of the young and the old and the most vulnerable, why not all of us? Why not everyone? And all of us in this big insurance pool. I mean, if you need to use corporate terms, let's do that. One big giant insurance company. And we can have four or five administrators if you want, but one big pot of money that makes sure everybody gets taken care of when they get sick. Sounds like a decent idea, right? At least something we should consider possibly maybe thinking about trying. Just a thought. Interesting day in history. Today, 1917, the psychiatrist W.H. Rivers presented his report, The Repression of War Experience. This is where the term shell shock came out of after World War One. According to the story at history.com, by the end of World War One, the Army had been forced to deal with 80,000 cases of shell shock. Like I said, termed after in 1917 by a medical officer named Charles Myers, because you had people who were on the front lines exposed to the heavy bombardment, the shelling, and they were completely incapacitated. Debilitating anxiety, nightmares, physical afflictions, you name it, loss of sight and hearing and you know, all kinds of stuff. And they came up with this idea that, you know what, we need to treat people. The difference was back then, so we need to get people back and get them ready for battle, get them back on the front lines. Sad reality is only one out of five ever got back and got treated in these hospitals that went back to military action. But today is when they came up with this. And one of the people who was treated for the shell shock was a poet, a guy named Wilfred Owens, who later wrote of his fellow inmates of Craig Lockhart in England. He said, "These are men whose minds are the dead have ravished. Memory fingers in their hair of murderers, multitudinous murderers they once witnessed." You know, the broken mind. And, you know, I look at this and I remember my childhood. I remember those guys coming back from Vietnam and just being dumped. And, you know, while we have gotten better from those days, we still have an awful long way to go. And, You know, speaking of shell shock, you know, I say that the Republicans have some measure of election shock. You know, they've been inundated with corporate propaganda, bombarded with focus-tested slogans and hyper-partisan, divisive rhetoric. You know, lies, lies, lies. So I found it interesting, the public polling policy people conducted their first post-election national poll. And what they find, they found that 49% of Republican voters nationally believe that Acorn, remember Acorn back 2006? Evidently, Acorn stole the 2012 election. Now, they've been defunct for years. Acorn does not exist. But yet 49% of Republicans, because they're told ad nauseum constantly, it's Acorn who's stealing elections. Right there with the Black Panther guy opening the door for those old people. 49%, which is, you know what's interesting? That's only down 3% from 2008. Understand, Acorn didn't exist in 2008 either. But 52% of Republicans in 2008 believed Acorn, that didn't exist, stole the election for Obama. And again, you go back and you go, never mind the facts, that little fact that they don't exist, never mind that. What you've got is you've got the party of crazy. 49% believe there's this boogeyman out there that doesn't exist. And what I find really kind of funny is there are a quarter of the Republicans in this country who want to secede from the union. They want their state to leave. And I'm like, well, why don't you just leave? Wouldn't that make it better? And of the poll, 56% want their state to stay in the union, and then there's the whopping 19% who, I'm not sure. And those are the people that always fascinate me, the, I'm not sure. Some other funny polling, if you will, Grover Norquist has a 15% favorable rating, still higher than Congress, kind of makes you wonder about that. He has a 37% negative rating, and 48% of the people don't care either way. 18% of Republicans see him in a positive light. President Obama's, his approval ratings have jumped up to 50%, which is, I guess, a good thing. The Simpson Bowl plan, not so much support. In fact, 23% support it, 16% oppose it. And again, the people who don't really have a clue, 60% say they don't care. They don't know either way. Kind of interesting there. My favorite one is the plan put out by Leon Panetta, former Clinton chief of staff and former Montana Republican Senator Conrad Burns. 8% of the people support the Panetta-Burns plan. 17% stand in stark opposition. Interestingly enough, I believe that, you know, and we've had these conversations with number of people. There are those who believe 40% of the American people are stupid. This only proves that 25% are stupid because there is no Panetta Burns plan. They made it up. It's a mythical thing. Just made it up. Just to see if anybody would pay attention or if they would just give opinions about things that they don't know a thing about. And, you know, you go and you think, you know, 25% of the Republicans spewing things that they know nothing about? Oh, yeah, right there. And finally, one of my favorite ones, David Petraeus has a 44% approval, 30% disapproval rating, which I guess, you know, is still better than the Republicans who have a 38-36 disapproval to approval rating. And look, I approve of David Petraeus. I don't care what he did in the confines of his four walls with Miss Broadwell. That's between him, his wife, and whoever it is that he looks up to the sky or wherever he looks to, between him, his maker, and, well, his family. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, Snowball Earth. It's a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, Earth was entirely covered by ice.
There's geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists haven't been able to agree on how an ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again. So they've never entirely accepted the snowball Earth theory.
In late 2012, a team of scientists from the U.S., Germany, and France published a paper about how a snowball Earth might have begun to melt. They used a computer model, the same sort of model used to study global warming in our time, to examine the role of clouds above an Earth entirely covered with ice.
In modern studies of climate, clouds play a complex role. They reflect sunlight and so help cool the Earth. And they also trap sunlight and so help warm the Earth. That's why clouds are a challenge in studies of global warming.
But a snowball Earth would have already been highly reflective, so the reflectivity of clouds would be less important, these scientists say. They say clouds' primary role would have been to trap heat and so start melting the ice, thawing the snowball Earth, and leading eventually to the world we know today. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words Snowball Earth. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
In a few moments, I will sign the North American Free Trade Act into law. The environmental and labor side agreements negotiated by our administration will make this agreement a force for social progress as well as economic growth.
The anniversary of that's coming up. This weekend, December 8th, I think it's Saturday. 1993, Clinton signed that into law. The NAFTA was supposed to create jobs, was supposed to be prosperous, raise all ships, make everybody happy. Yeah. And now we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the free trade agreement of free trade agreements, the end of them. We won't have to worry about it because of the add-on agreement portion of that. That will make that the permanent. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff coming down the road. You know, earlier in the program, we talked about privatizing the state's lottery system. And, you know, they wanted to private hawk off the state wine and spirit shops, the turnpike, anything that fire sale, anything we can get rid of, anything that we, the people, we do for ourselves, we should be privatizing it, make sure the very wealthy take their cut, of course, because evidently we're incapable of doing for ourselves things that need to be done, like police and fire and, you know, trash and all the things that we used to. So the question is there anything out there that has been privatized that's benefited people like me, people like you, society as a whole, who benefits? Which is why I've asked Mike Konzel, fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. He has a new white paper out with New America's Renewing the American Social Contract series. It's titled No Discount, Comparing the Public Option to the Coupon Welfare State. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mike Konzel's name. It'll take you right there. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
So anything that we've privatized, I mean, before we get into your piece, anything that you can think of that we've privatized that's benefited people like me, working folks, I mean, really, that being the focus of it that I've benefited from?
I mean, none jumps to mind as being a major driver of prosperity. I mean, when you look at a lot of the privatization, you know, there's been this assumption it would, you know, increase innovation or make things more cost efficient or, you know, give some sort of dividend to taxpayers. But usually what it is, it just means that there's some sort of rent-seeking private middleman who gets between you and the service and gets a cut of it, which yep. is exactly the opposite of what we want to be doing.
So when I look at the Republican plan for Medicare, for instance, this whole voucher thing, we're going to give subsidies, we're going to give vouchers, whatever. To me, again, it's this, as you pointed out in your piece, it's the coupon thing. We're not going to do it for ourselves. We're going to make sure that someone gets a cut of it.
Exactly. When you look at so part of the piece argues that the size of the government is roughly stable among the different political parties. The question is who benefits and who delivers the services. So in a lot of Democrats, especially kind of the more neoliberal centrist Democrats, but crucially when you look at something like the Ryan plan, I mean, the original Ryan plan, we had what? It had privatized Social Security. So instead of the old age pension, which prevents you from starving to death in old age and eating cat food, you know, Wall Street will help you invest and take a huge cut and probably give you the bad stocks they don't want. Or crucially, things like healthcare are something that we run through middlemen. And what the piece argues is that, you know, that is such a default for a lot of the ways policymakers think about these things, especially kind of very serious policymakers. But there's huge problems with the arguments. And there's so many reasons why we want the government to be providing these services directly. It's a better alternative that provides better results.
Yeah, I mean, I think Medicare is the perfect example of it. I mean, the overhead cost, the cost of the executives who run it, the cost to the shareholders, because we don't have to pay out dividends, is less. It just makes sense to me that that money that we would be handing out to the shareholders and to the CEOs and for advertising and all of that other stuff would go into actually taking care of people. That seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the social insurance part of it, so I kind of identify four big reasons why public provisioning is very good. Social insurance is, you know, when we have one risk pool that's the country, it's much easier for us to manage risk. And you look at something like Medicare, it does a lot better job of controlling costs than private health care. Especially when you see something like voucherizing Medicare, you can see private insurers, they're going to take the healthiest people, they're going to take the best subsidies, and they're going to pay out the worst services. They're going to, you know, they're going to try to cream the system, they're going to try to juke the system in such a way that insurance is a huge bonus for them. And especially when you talk about things like, you know, the public sector does not have that kind of dividend payout. It doesn't need to manipulate its short-term stock prices to make executives happy. But it also has a public purpose. So if there's innovations, it's much more comfortable for the government to share them, as opposed to, like, proprietary, closed-down third-party systems where a lot of the innovation is just going to – they may even bury innovations if necessary.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at the talk around privatizing the state's lottery system here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, all the things they're talking about, you know, doing some different things, offering new games, you know, all of these different things the state could do for itself. We don't need a for-profit company to come in and take a large portion of the money that would be created by expanding operations and getting more people to buy tickets. We could do that for ourselves if it were good for society and it were good for the rest of the state. We could do that ourselves without having this profit-seeking entity taking money from the programs that benefit seniors. I mean, we can have a whole argument about should we be using the lottery to fund programs for seniors, but, you know, that is what it is. But do we need this private company to help with that?
Exactly. And, you know, when you look at something like private prisons are kind of the extreme example of this, a lot of times a lot of times this privatization makes regulation even more important. So you see a lot of conservatives argue, well, you know, privatizing means there's no government regulation, so government's off people's backs. But when you actually look at it, you know, a lot of these government powers are really kind of, you know, they're government powers. So, like, when we imprison someone and let private companies do it, we write them huge books of regulations because we don't want people starving in prison so some executive gets a bonus. But since we're going to dictate the terms of how these things happen, and I'm not familiar exactly with the lottery system, but I'm sure there's heavy regulations about under what conditions they can sell to and who they can sell to. Why don't we just do it ourselves if we're going to write all the rules for it?
And that is my point from the beginning, the money that we would be giving to them in profits. Because, look, they're not going to put up a whole ton of money if they didn't know they're not going to make it back. And I go back to what I said earlier. We had Donna Cooper on the program, who I guess is now over at the Center for American Progress. She was in the Rendell administration. And when they were talking about privatizing and leasing off the turnpike, she said that the finance people came in and said they not only want to guarantee that they're going to make a profit, they want to guaranteed by the state that they're going to make the same profit they would have made by using that money anywhere else. So the opportunity cost was guaranteed to them, and then they would take over control of the state's turnpike system. And it just blew my mind that they're that brazen and they wield that kind of power.
I mean, that's the exact definition of crony capitalism. I mean, you know, like the whole point of markets is that you're supposed to have winners and losers, and, you know, the best ideas will rise to the top and so on and so forth. But if the government's going to step and say, we're just going to make sure that you're a winner with taxpayer dollars, there's better ways to do that. We could just do it ourselves and not have that huge conflict and not essentially be buying off third parties for the ability to provide crucial services for our citizens.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, when Romney and Ryan were running around, especially Ryan running around with his voucher plan, are there any conditions where these vouchers are a good thing? Because when I look at the Medicare voucher thing, I think it's just a horrible idea when you're talking about doing this, giving my grandmother this golden ticket that no one's ever going to cash. Do you see any good in vouchers?
Well, if you think the best idea for how to deal with healthcare costs is to push healthcare costs on old people themselves, then it's a great plan. I mean, that's exactly what it's designed to do. It's you know, you get so much covered, and this is the whole thing about coupons is that, you know, you spend it, and then if there's any extra cost that goes to you, good luck. You're on your own. That's clearly how it's supposed to contain costs in that way.
But isn't that rationing?
It's rationing through a different mechanism. The problem is it's just a bad system because the government itself can contain these costs much better by ensuring that everyone's in them by using this kind of law, by using its ability to essentially use its purchasing power. I mean, it doesn't use it all the time. It's not obviously using it with prescription drugs under the Bush administration and now under the Obama administration.
Thanks, Billy Townsend.
That's ultimately what we want is the government as the provider here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you can thank Billy Townsend for that, the former congressman from Louisiana, who, as soon as he strong-armed that deal through, took that big paying gig with Big Pharma after doing their bidding, which I still think should be illegal. I think he should be behind bars, but that's just a whole other discussion for another day. So let me ask you this. Doesn't this really, Mike, come down to us people, my listeners, people who vote, who say, you know what, at some point there are things that we, the people, can do through our government that is much better than a private for-profit corporation, which is kind of the antithesis of what's been rammed down our throats in the media for the last 30 years?
Exactly. I mean, like, the last 30 years has had this kind of market worship where the market is, you know, exciting and emancipatory and, you know, innovative, and it does all this cool stuff. But now, you know, we're looking at math. What is the market giving us right now? Mass unemployment, huge corporate profits with wages stagnating or declining, you know, a young generation that is, you know, not finding work, an older generation that has huge insecurity with its retirement. And suddenly this market thing seems like not so great, or it seems to have a really bad double-edged sword. And when it comes to providing security, economic security, retirement security, health security, the government suddenly has all these really good advantages that citizens instinctively understand. It's people, like, it's the very serious people in D.C. It is Democrats and Republicans, especially Republicans, who are still kind of wedded to this market logic, part for crony reasons, because, I mean, those payouts are real when they go get those lobbying jobs, but I think part just because, like, of an ideological straitjacket. They just don't know how to – they've lost their way to understand how liberalism is supposed to work.
Yeah, and that's a sad thing. You know, but for me, I look at it and, you know, I have people telling me, you know, Rick, corporations always do things better. They're always much better at efficiency, and there's no waste, fraud, and abuse. And I go, well, obviously, you don't know anything about corporate America.
Right. And, you know, there are things we want basic minimums. I mean, we don't want people eating cat food in old age. We don't want a healthcare system that lets someone die because they can't afford a kidney transplant. We don't, you know, we don't want prisoners being subject to private dividends or, you know, being put in harsher conditions so, like, someone can get a bonus.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that?
Well,
I mean, because I got to be honest, I know a lot of people who think those are pretty good ideas. We've got a governor in this state who wants to privatize everything. So I don't think everyone agrees with you on that.
Well, crucially, I think, you know, there's a saying that Americans are rhetorically conservative but operationally liberal, which means, like, they don't like the idea of it, but at the end of the day, they don't want their friends, they don't want their families, they don't want their communities, they don't want themselves being subject to those conditions. So even though they speak a rhetoric that is very free market, kind of like laissez-faire right-wing free market, at the end of the day, I think the social contract that came out of the New Deal still holds for most people. It is cynical politicians. It is a very small sliver of people who either are ideologically don't want it, or there's a sliver of people who think that they just don't want other people to have it, people they don't like, which is a separate problem.
And that's coming up with our pension fight here soon. You know, and do you see it as I do that? It's all we've been told. It's what we've been spoon-fed for the last 30 years. That, you know, that's the whole message, what you just laid out?
Well, you know, Bill Clinton said that the era of big government is over. And then, you know, it turns out we had a gigantic Great Depression-sized financial crisis, which would have been Great Depression-level devastation if it wasn't for big government, if it wasn't for food stamps going out and Social Security checks being delivered on time and stimulus and the Federal Reserve. The point right now is to really emphasize, like, these things matter, and they matter for people's lives, and there is no alternative to it. Corporations can't do this work. They're not designed to do it, and yep. They're ultimately not designed to provide basic welfare to people. That's the role of the government here.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Last question I've got for you, and looking at the fiscal mirage that's coming up, I mean, if you saw the Boehner budget, you know, the we want people dying in the street seems to be it. They want to cut and gut Medicare and Social Security, push those benefits off, make them stingier. They want to take food out of the mouths of children. So that social contract that we talk about, I don't think they see it the same way we do.
It's crazy. I mean, Boehner, they're out there saying, like, look, cut Social Security, cut health care, so we can keep taxes low on rich people. It's the worst message. And I'm glad it seems like Obama is aware of this and starting to put pressure on it. I mean, I'm assuming you don't get a lot of callers in the radio station super excited about how well their 401k is doing, right?
Yeah.
Social Security is only going to be more important going forward, and preserving that old age pension, preserving that economic security, it's going to be crucial in decades ahead. The idea that it would be thrown away over a made-up artificial crisis is insane. It's an indictment of how bad politics has gotten in this situation.
Yeah, it is the fiscal mirage. Mike Counsell, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. And you take a look at his new piece, the No Discount, comparing the public option to the coupon welfare state. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike Counsell's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members. Did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
What exactly does that mean? It's just a bunch of garble. And same thing with all this privatization. And again, I've yet to find anybody who's come up with a scheme that where this has benefited people like me. And maybe Rich has got an idea. I've got Rich online, too. How are you doing tonight, Rich?
Hey, pretty good. How are you doing, Rich?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Hey, I live in Ohio, and I'm a truck driver. I drive the York PA every night.
All righty.
And you was talking about the lottery in your first hour.
Yes, sir.
Well, I was wanting to know why we can't propose a national lottery for, like, Medicare, Social Security, and infrastructure.
Why would we want one?
Well, it would pay for itself on the funding.
Well, the problem with the lottery is the exact problem we had here in Pennsylvania. You had the collapse in 2008, and you saw funding go through the floor. So at times when you actually need to make sure that you have secure funding, like during times of economic crisis, you're not going to have it. I see a huge problem with that. And to me, you know, the whole lottery thing depends on folks having disposable income. And that's a problem, especially now that we've seen wages being destroyed and we've seen, you know, the ability of workers to bargain for those wages being diminished. I'm curious, why would you want a lottery system for that?
Well, because of how these Republicans are, they want to just cut. And it affects my mom when they do this.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what it should be is you and me and other folks like us getting angry at them and throwing the bums out.
Well, I've tried my part, but it's trying to get the people to understand what their policies are.
Yeah, well, and that's why we have programs like this, and which is why we need to be talking to our friends and neighbors. And look, as this stuff comes up, we got to be talking to people.
It's just some of them are so diehard Republican, it kills me.
Yeah, it blows my mind that, you know, the very people who are the ones being harmed by the policy that they're advocating are the people fighting for the policy it's just the sad reality is it is what it is, but we've got to keep fighting along.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I've taken a pay cut for the last 20 years driving trucks.
Oh, I know. You know, the sad reality, I drove a truck for years myself, and, you know, I've got my grandfather's contract from 1976 through 70, or 74 through 79 here on my desk. And in 1979, a truck driver was making $31 an hour in today's dollars with full health care, eye, dental, and a retirement package, the vacation laid out in this contract, sick days, all of that stuff. And we've allowed this to be stolen from us.
Well, you know, it was Reaganomics that started all this.
Absolutely. But it was beyond that. It was this whole neoliberal agenda, this whole push for deregulation. And it's beyond just Reagan and Republicans. It's a lot of bent-knee corporate Democrats as well. These neoliberals are just as bad.
We
need to call them out as well and hold them accountable and throw those bums out, too.
Well, I got Representative Bill Johnson. I've called and called his office, and them people won't return my calls back.
Yeah, I've got a crazy representative myself, but I make sure I call and leave email and send messages.
They were calling when right before the elections, and after the elections was over, you didn't hear from them.
Yeah, it's you know, this is where you know. I think it's so important, especially as a truck driver, to talk to the other drivers. Because I got to be honest, when I was doing organizing, I was amazed at how many right-wing truck drivers there are who think that all of the negative things that are happening to them are the fault of those liberals. Those liberals are doing all this stuff. You know, the people who brought us labor unions?
Well, you get into some nasty fights over the radio.
I've been there myself. Been there myself, Rich.
I just don't understand the people. They want to have Social Security, but yet they want to take these tax breaks, and, you know, I just can't accept taking tax breaks that have benefits.
Now, let me ask you about you mentioned your grandmother a second ago and how this is going to affect her. You know, what do you see happening to her?
No, actually, it's my mother. She's on Social Security now, but they're talking about freezing the...
Changing the COLA.
Yeah, the income for every year on the increase.
Yep.
And she's only getting like $651 a month. Now that's just tragic, you know.
That's infuriating. It is what it is. And what you've got is they're going to freeze a couple of dollar increase that she would get every year, so that we can give hundreds of thousands, if not millions, to the very top of the very wealthy people in this country who don't need it and aren't going to use it to create jobs. To me, that's something to be just absolutely furious about and take to the streets.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'd rather see us go over the cliff myself.
And I'm hoping the president holds firm on this. Because I think the Republicans lose on that. They created this mirage. They created this crisis, this hostage situation. And just as easily as they created it, they can undo it. So any pain and suffering that happens is because the Republicans in this country want it to happen.
Yeah, it's just like I shake my head that, you know, I'm from Ohio, and Boehner has nobody running against you.
Yeah, well, that's in Pennsylvania, too. There are a lot of the representatives, because they've drawn these districts that are so badly gerrymandered and so manipulated that nobody really has a chance. I mean, where I live, it's a 60-40 district. A Democrat, the savior himself could come down here and not get elected in that district, because what we've done in politics is it's team sport. My team's going to win. Instead of talking about the policies that are going to help your mother and my grandmother and help us as working people, they don't want to do that. It's wave the flag for the team. That's what we want to talk about. But again, you know, it's the wealth class who's put us in this position, and we need to break down those barriers.
See, that's like he was talking about Walmart, and they put a distribution center in my county.
Right.
My county gave them a 10-year freeze on no taxes, which was ridiculous. I voted against it, but the majority wanted them to put the business there to get the economy going.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just gave $1.7 billion to a cracker plant that they were going to build in that location anywhere because, hey, the gas is here. They weren't going anywhere else. I got to take a break right here, Rich. I appreciate the call. Next time you're in town, look us up.
I'm here every night, so I listen to your show every day.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
Bud.
Take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast, or Stitcher on your smartphone. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. With budget talks stalemated for now in Washington, President Obama holding the line, insisting on tax increases for the top 2%, economist Dean Baker is urging people to calm down about the so-called fiscal cliff.
A lot of people in Washington are really trying to hype it. You know, certainly the term itself, fiscal cliff, you know, we're going to fall off the edge. It's almost impossible to imagine a scenario come, you know, whether it's January 5th, January 10th, you don't see a deal pretty quickly between the President and Congress. They get tax rates back down to the current levels for the rest of us. And, you know, for the top 2%, that's what we had the election over. They're going to pay higher taxes.
Baker says Social Security is fine far into the future, while raising the cap on income subject to the Social Security tax would close any funding gaps in decades to come. He says Medicare can be sustained, but we have to bring health care costs down. And he says raising wages while narrowing income inequality would go a long way toward fixing budget imbalances.
Now, over a long term, we should be seeing wage growth. The longer term problem, certainly, you know, the fact that the winners, the beneficiaries of economic growth have been almost exclusively those at the top end over the last three decades, that's a really big deal. I mean, that's created the sort of imbalances that got us into this.
Walmart could make a massive contribution to the U.S. economy simply by giving its workers a small wage increase. Jesse Russell reports.
Increasing the wages of workers who earn $21,000 on average per year to $25,000 per year would lift 700,000 Americans above the poverty line. That's according to a study released by the think tank Demos, which focused specifically on the low wages of the retail sector. The study shows that giving what amounts to a 27% raise to workers at companies which employ 1,000 workers or more would have a ripple effect impacting more than 5 million retail workers and their families. Nearly 770,000 workers currently just above the poverty line would see their incomes rise 150% above that line. According to Demos, such an increase would see the GDP rise by between $11.8 billion and $15.2 billion next year. The overall growth from increased spending power would allow for the creation of an additional 100,000 to 132,000 jobs.
The Coalition Against Segregation of Temporary Employees, CAST, is filing a class action discrimination suit in Chicago today, alleging that Johnson & Johnson supplier VPAC, Inc., is systematically discriminating against African Americans in temporary agency hiring. After they file the suit, activists will inform shoppers at the Chicago-Austin Walmart about the alleged discrimination. Supporting actions are also being held by worker activists today in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and in Los Angeles.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's intimidating, but it's nothing we are willing to back down on, you know? I mean, we're not just out there fighting for our own rights. We're out there fighting a company like Walmart. We're fighting for every associate they hire worldwide.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, you look at Thanksgiving Thursday, the actions across the U.S., and historic actions at that, that the fact that you had thousands of people taking to the streets, calling on Walmart to do much better for their employees. And I look at our quote of the day by Martha Yuval, one of the original folks here in the U.S. Who went out on strike against Walmart's supply chain, saying, "We were hungry, we were tired, and we were thinking, what if we could invite all the Walmart workers in the supply chain to do just a one-hour strike?" Think of the power, the power of all of those people globally coming together and calling on the world's largest corporation to do better, to treat their workers with a little bit of dignity and respect. Wow, how powerful that could be. And you know what? I think it's going to come to pass, which is why I've asked Elka Boseger, head of commerce with the UNI Global Union. Well, Elka, thanks for taking time for me.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You know, I look at, you know, here on Thanksgiving, we saw across the United States, we saw workers in just about every state taking to the front of the stores and informing the customers, hey, this is the treatment working people here at Walmart have to endure, a historic moment. But I'd love to see that, and a lot of people would love to see that go global to draw more attention to this behemoth, this global behemoth.
It it might actually be a surprise to your listeners, Rick, but Walmart is actually a company that is unionized in other parts of the world. We're working with unions in countries like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and South Africa, where workers have already got a union at Walmart, where they have been able to get a voice on the job, and that's exactly what we believe workers in the U.S. Deserve as well. We believe that every worker who works for Walmart around the world should have the right to speak on the job and to lead a life that allows them to have a decent life, to have health insurance, to send their kids to college, and to make that move into the middle class. We just don't believe it's fair that people work very, very hard, and they are not able to afford a decent lifestyle from the money that they're earning.
Yeah, and that, the important part of that is, look, I mean, these are working people. These are people who get up every day. They punch the clock. They do the job. They create the wealth that in this country anyway, and a lot of other countries, the wealth is being accumulated by the handfuls. And I just saw something yesterday where the top four Walmart heirs have something like over $110 billion in accumulated wealth. And you go, that's made off the backs of low-wage workers, not only in the U.S., but in many other countries throughout the world.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, we're all very familiar with the profits that the company is making, that the owners of the company are making, and the shareholders, how they're benefiting from the all the money that the company is being making with their business model. But at the same time, We also believe that if the company just raised the wages a little bit so that all their workers could afford a decent lifestyle, that would increase the disposable income for those workers, which also would have a big, big impact on the economy in the United States as such. And we all know that the American economy could do with a bit of a boost just now.
Right.
And because there are so many people working at the company, it would have a big trigger-on effect. And I think Walmart would be the company who should look at that and who should, as a leader in their business, take responsibility also on that angle.
Yeah, I mean, by putting more money in their workers' pockets, it would have a huge stimulative effect, not only for the country, but I would argue for Walmart as well, because most of their workers, well, they shop there.
Absolutely. And what we're trying to do with this global alliance is to build a broad alliance of workers, of customers, of all kinds of different stakeholders who believe that everybody who works or shops at Walmart has a responsibility and also should have an interest in holding this company accountable.
So you pointed out a minute ago that in other countries, Walmart workers are unionized. And you know, those are countries that actually I think have probably better labor law than we have here in the U.S. If you look at our laws, they're kind of fractured and broken and, well, kind of outdated. In other countries, their labor laws aren't as antiquated as ours and actually have some teeth so workers can organize. Can you talk to that a little bit, maybe what other countries have that the U.S. doesn't?
Certainly there are countries out there where the labor law is more favorable for workers, but I don't think that's the only thing that is holding back workers in the U.S. to be organized, because there are a lot of companies, particularly in the retail sector in the U.S., that have a union, their workers do have a voice in the job. But Walmart in the U.S. is notoriously anti-union. They are scaring the workers from becoming unionized. But not only that, they're scaring workers from talking about the challenges that they're facing in their daily work on the job. And that's really where I think the company is not taking its responsibility serious. If it says we want to be a good employer for our employees, that also means that they have to listen to them and not retaliate against them if they raise issues. And often the issues that they're raising would actually be good for the business of the company. In other countries around the world, we have unions that have organized workers. They have collective agreements. If there are issues that need to be discussed, then the union and the company sit down together around the table and they resolve those issues. And I think that's what we're asking for the company to do in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, I'm with you. But you know, going back to our labor law here in this country, we seem to with the number of stalls and delays and the punitive and the small amount of penalties that a company would face for the retaliation and the harassment and discrimination, it almost encourages it by not having strong enough laws against it.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think it's absolutely not in the interest of the American society, the American economy, those anti-union laws, because if looking at the situation of the companies where unions are represented, the workers are usually better off there, which means they have a more disposable income, which means they can spend more money, and that would be good for the entire society and for the entire economy.
Yeah, you know, my grandmother worked as a like a cashier at Walmart, at a very small department store in the Cleveland area, from the, you know, the late 1950s all the way up until 1987. And I was looking at, because she was a member of a union here in the U.S., the UFCW, and I was looking at some of their contracts, and the wages that she was paid in 1987 were higher than they are today, and she had full health care, 6 weeks vacation, paid sick time, full, you know, eye, dental, all of that, and a pension that she's collecting to this day. And I look at Walmart, who has made their massive profits off of taking those things back. And also, you know, making sure that jobs are being outsourced and we're squeezing every penny out of the supply chain. And I say, you know, the economy that my grandparents built with a strong, burgeoning middle class, that's what we should be looking to replicate, not this Walmart version.
Absolutely. I believe that the American people should actually be ashamed for Walmart to be the business model that is being upheld and promoted everywhere. They should be ashamed of the development that you have just described, because if you are not able to live off the job that you are doing, and the workers at Walmart are very committed, they're working very, very hard, and they still cannot afford health care for their children, they still cannot afford to send their children to college. That is something that the company should be ashamed of, and particularly if you think that those who are the decision makers in the company, they are certainly well covered, they have health care, and they take so much money home that they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, you know, we had a guy who was just elected to Congress, Alan Grayson. He was reelected, you know, after a term off. And he said, you know, you look at, you know, the largest recipient of public aid. You want to talk about a welfare queen? Well, that welfare queen is Walmart, because they are the largest recipient of public tax dollars, be it through health care, be it through heating assistance, food stamps, all of these social programs. And it's we, the taxpayers, who are subsidizing this low-wage model. And at some point, I'm hoping the American people wake up to the reality that we're subsidizing the largest global corporation to continue a low-wage model.
That's right. There is something fundamentally wrong with the way the taxes are being paid in the U.S. and the way subsidies are being handed out to companies. And I hope that that the government and the different parliamentarian institutions that you have and the people themselves will wake up one day and demand a change to that situation.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Alka Boseger, head of commerce with the UNI Global Union. You know, Alka, you know, and I look at this, I guess my question for you as being the head of this global organization, how does the rest of the world view what's going on here? I mean, does the rest of the world look to us, the U.S., as the leader and, hey, this is the direction we should be going? Or are they looking at us going, hey, what are you doing? This is the race to the bottom. You're pulling us all down.
I think the world looks at the U.S., as a model in many ways, but certainly not when it comes to labor relations and worker rights. From the point of view of the unions and the workers that we're working with, because what we're doing as uni is connecting workers, connecting unions in the leading multinational retailers. And what we're seeing is that the U.S. is really less almost than a developing country, I could say, in terms of the rights that it grants to its workers.
So how much of this is directly related to our insane trade policies in this country, this whole neoliberal free trade mantra?
I'm not sure about that. The funny thing is that with the labor law being so weak in the United States, at the same time, the U.S. government demands very strict conditions from countries that they're trading with. So there is a real imbalance here, and because the U.S. is so big and so powerful, they can put those conditions on their trading partners, but they don't abide by these same conditions in their own country.
Right, absolutely. Let me ask you this. You know, I saw the tragedy that happened in Bangladesh, and, you know, Walmart and everybody else ran away. Oh, we don't deal with those folks, even though we know they do deal with a lot of situations in those countries, very extremely low-wage sweatshop countries. Where I think that, you know, by having their buying power, by having their power around the world, they can actually lift those conditions up for those workers and make sure that stuff doesn't happen. Yet I fear that we're not doing enough.
That's exactly right. I mean, but the way that Walmart is keeping the prices for the product that it sells low is by seeking complete control over its supply chain. And nobody can tell me with the control that they're exercising over their supply chain that they don't know where from which factories they're sourcing from. So I think that the reaction that we saw from Walmart to the fire, for instance, in Bangladesh was a very, very weak one. And even if you outsource jobs to other companies, you have a responsibility as the client for the conditions that are happening in that supplier, and particularly because Walmart were aware of issues at that company, and they have rather than having taken action to get those conditions changed and improved, they just walk away from it, and that's absolutely irresponsible.
Yeah, but it's at the end of the day, their concern and what they'll tell you is our commitment is to the lowest price for our consumers, even if those consumers are workers who don't make sufficient wages to buy those. It's just really this snowballing downward, this terminal velocity free fall to the bottom, not even a race.
That's right. And they're playing with the situation that workers in the U.S. have less disposable income for the own goods that they're buying. So they're trying to keep their clients by lowering their own prices even further. And the only way they can do that is by putting even more pressure on their supply chain and the manufacturers in those countries. But, you know, I believe if consumers are just a little bit more interested in where the goods are coming from that they are buying, they would find that it is unacceptable under the conditions under which many of these goods are being produced. And it's not actually, it wouldn't be a big deal for either for Walmart or for consumers to pay 10 cents more, and that may help workers in the supply chain to work under different conditions.
Yeah, I agree. Next Friday, I understand the Global Day of Action. Tell me what's the Day of Action going to entail? How big are you hoping this is going to get, and what are the demands?
The Global Day of Action that we're running on the 14th, 15th of December next week is a global day of action where all the unions and the workers that we're uniting in our Uni Global Walmart Alliance to demand respect and a voice on the job for Walmart workers around the world. We are working with our unions in all the countries where workers are unionized to run actions in their own countries, in Walmart stores in their countries, and there will also be actions happening in the United States. And we don't see this just as a solidarity day for workers in the United States, but we see this as an opportunity to highlight the anti-union, anti-worker policies of the company, and we're going to answer with actions, and we're going to continue to demand from Walmart that they behave responsibly as the global leader in the retail industry.
Yep. Well, what's the follow-up to the Day of Action? I mean, obviously this is going to be a big day where we're hoping to get as many people out into the streets and highlighting, but where do you go from there? I mean, at the end of the day, what we've seen out of Walmart here in the U.S. is that they minimize, well, this is just a handful of disgruntled people. How do you move that to the next step?
We're in discussions with a lot of different groups who are uniting around this issue of improving conditions for workers at Walmart. There are unions involved, community groups, groups of faith who are joining together because they believe it's no longer acceptable for Walmart to get away with the minimum conditions, the bad conditions that they're giving to their workers. And we believe that a company like Walmart that is the global leader in their industry, that it's time for them to sit down and ensure that workers, wherever they have stores, have decent working conditions and decent rights.
And wherever they have products manufactured in their supply
Absolutely.
Chain.
Absolutely, throughout the entire supply chain, of course.
Because if this one company, I mean, just think about this, if this one global company would say, well, we're going to raise up everyone else, they would have to bring everyone with them, or am I off base?
That's exactly why it's so important for us to improve conditions at Walmart. They are the global leader. They are setting the standards. They are the model for they are the providing the business model for retail. It's because of them that standards in the retail industry have gone down, and that's why it's so important for us that we get Walmart to accept that they have a responsibility not just for their own workers but for the entire industry.
What do you say to the people who said, well, it's a competitive market, you know, it's the free market, and if Walmart wants to do better, they may want to do better, but you know what? The rest of the industry just won't let them. The Targets and the Kohl's and the Dillard's and all of these other chains, they're going to continue to the race to the bottom, even if Walmart takes a different path. What do you say to those folks?
It's certainly a very, very difficult question, and that's why we're working, for instance, with shareholders in the different companies, because we believe that they have a very important role to play. If shareholders believe, and if the owners of the companies believe, that it is not acceptable to make a profit at any price at the back of the workers who are actually creating this wealth for the company, then I think we can change this whole model.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it still comes down to me, the consumer slash worker, actually the worker slash consumer, because at the end of the day, I still need to work to be able to be a consumer.
That's right, exactly. And consumers need to be informed about the conditions under which the goods are being manufactured that they're buying at Walmart, and also about the conditions in which the workers that are selling those goods are being treated.
Yeah, and which is why the Global Day of Action, why the education process needs to happen. And you know, how do we get involved? How do my listeners get involved in this? You know, what kind of things will we find? Is there a place that they should go on the web, maybe, that will get them a little more information?
Yeah, so we have set up, as the Uni Walmart Global Union Alliance, a Facebook page where we are all the information about the different actions that are happening around the world are being posted, where we have worker stories there, and where workers and unions from around the world will post information, photos, videos from the different actions that are happening around the world. So if you go to Facebook and you type in Uni Global Walmart Alliance, you will get to that page and you find all the information there.
And we'll make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Elka Boseger's name. Last question I've got for you. You know, some people are going to look at what you guys are doing and what, you know, workers across this country have done to this point and say, well, these are people who just want to tear Walmart down. This isn't about tearing them down, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. We believe that it's important that we get them to change their business model, to recognize that they have a responsibility. But Uni's interest is always to build a dialogue with companies so that we take joint responsibility for the company's success, but also sharing that success with the workers who are creating it.
Yeah, and it's about rewarding those companies who do well and rewarding the people who are moving in the right direction, correct?
That's exactly right. That's the companies that we want to promote, and that's the companies on which we would like Walmart to model their own business.
Absolutely. Elka Boseger, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. We'd love to have you back after the Day of Action at some point.
It was great talking to you. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Elka Boseger. Quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One of these days we want to wake up.
Show, changing America for the better.
Are you feeling that back to school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year. If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pfecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Born in 1930 in Schiller Park, Illinois, the deceased was 82 years old at the time of passing, the day before Thanksgiving. Having enjoyed the sweet life, the end was a bit bitter, for the estate of the dearly departed had been mercilessly plundered in recent years by unscrupulous money managers, leaving 18,500 surviving family members in dire straits. Indeed, the family contends that the octogenarian's death was not due to natural causes, but to foul play. This is the drama behind the death of Twinkies, fondly remembered as the cream puff of the proletariat, and less fondly as a sugar and fat bomb that was a toothache in one bite and a heart attack in the next. This industrial concoction became an American icon. The father of the Twinkie was a baker at the Old Continental Baking Company. He saw the product as a way to keep the factory's confection machinery busy after strawberry shortcake season. Yes, the Twinkie was actually conceived as food for idle machines. How fitting is that? But us humans happily swallowed this extruded marvel of comestible engineering. The Twinkie was the bestseller of Hostess Brands, a conglomerate purveyor of some 30 nutritionally challenged brand-name foods, ranging from Wonder Bread to Ho-Ho's. In the past year, Hostess racked up $2.5 billion in sales. Yet it suffered a staggering $1.1 billion in losses. Thus, Ripplewood Holdings, the private equity outfit that had taken over the conglomerate in 2009, solemnly announced that Hostess simply could not survive. Why? Because, executives said, the company's greedy labor unions would not take pay cuts to save it. This is Jim Hightower saying, wait a minute, the bereaved loved ones are to blame? Holy Agatha Christie, that can't be right. Tune in tomorrow for the real story of Who Killed the Twinkie.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married. That is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone, and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl. It's good to know it's cause to give.
Yes, blame it on the gays. It's their fault. Everything's their fault. Nothing could possibly be the fault of the wealth class who have sucked all the investable assets out of the, well, you know the drill. I mean, look at the Walton situation. You got four sperm lottery winners. And for those who love the lottery, and I appreciated the call earlier, Richie, I've been thinking about the idea of a lottery. And, you know, the lottery that the wealth class wins is the sperm lottery. And you look at the four sperm lottery winners, Christy Walton, Jim Walton, Rob Walton, and Alice Walton. They have a combined fortune of over $110 billion. That's the kind of winning. And understand, you know, they got it the old-fashioned way. They didn't even have to put a dollar down. They inherited it. And you look at the fact that the corporate profits have never higher, corporate earnings never higher, wages never lower. In the years we've been tracking this stuff, never lower. And, you know, Rich asked the question, why not have a lottery for infrastructure, a lottery for Medicare, a lottery for Social Security? And the more I think about this, the more I'm against the idea. There could not be a more regressive way of doing it. Because understand who would then end up funding it completely. The wealth class understands return on investment. You don't see many billionaires hitting the lottery, do you? When they do their gambling, they do their gambling on Wall Street, where they pay 15% capital gains on it. When we have a lottery win, it is the highest possible tax rate. You know, that rate that we reserve for the very, very wealthy in this country. And I look at what economist Victor Matheson said. He said, you look at lotteries. They are the worst expected return of just about any gambling you could possibly do. And he estimated that slots paid out about 95 cents on the dollar. So if you were, the more you gamble, the more you go through it, you're going to lose 5%. 95 cents, that's the kind of return you're going to get, the kind of prizes that come back. A good blackjack player, could get as much about as 98 cents of the dollar back. Lotteries in the range of 50 cents, as high as maybe 60 cents. And you look at, you know, the Bloomberg News had this sucker index. They pointed out that the poorer states, states like Georgia, had the highest rates of people spending money, poor people spending money on this lottery, because that's the retirement system. Oh, if we could just win that lottery. And it becomes the addict mentality. If I could just win that lottery, I could retire and I could be like those people. Instead of, you know, squirreling away that buck or $2 or $5 or $10 a week into Social Security or into some type of retirement program, now it's become a lottery. And to do that with our infrastructure, to do that with everything else, would allow the wealth class in this country to completely abandon us. And then they'd say, well, we gave you the lottery. You've got the lottery. Which, again, is my problem with what we've done with programs for seniors in this state. Well, the lottery funds it. Well, is that how we treat that generation? Sorry, the lottery didn't bring in enough revenue this time. You don't get to stay in the nursing home. And I go back and I look at this whole push towards privatization that the right keeps trying to shove down our throat. And it's a horrible failure of an idea. But we've got a governor who doesn't have to go through the legislature, doesn't have to get any public input. We have no say in it. He's going to impose it. Our little dictator, our czar, if you will, he's going to impose it. No hearings, no oversight, no sunshine, no daylight, none of that. Going to impose it. We're going to give that contract because he can. And I looked at it, you know, during the break, I looked up a couple of things. You know, in 2011, 2012, sales are nearly $3.5 billion. Profits of more than $1 billion. Never been higher. Record year. But Camelot, the company that's going to take over, they're not guaranteeing that level. Oh, no, no. And understand, for the last year, we've seen profits and the lottery profits go up 10% than they were a year ago. And they're on pace to go for another record year. And you know what? It's been lowballed. So that increase that would have gone, since we've seemed to believe in funding our programs that take care of our most vulnerable through gambling off the backs of workers and especially low-wage workers, where's that money then going to go once we privatize it? Because according to the information that I've got, the bid that Camelot came up with has front-loaded the profit projections. First few years, you know, pretty good. The last 10 years guarantees only 1% growth. So what happens if we have 10% growth all those years? Who keeps that? Oh, yeah, they do. They get the money. And, oh, by the way, if those last 10 years continues, they get to continue that contract for 10 more years automatically. Again, with no input from you or me. Think about 10, 20 years, 30 years down the road. And my favorite part of this whole lottery privatization scheme, and the one that caught my attention, and the one that tells me this is why Tom Corbett is doing this. This is why the Republicans are pushing for it. Because the gaming law of 2004 that was pushed through during the Rendell years, the casinos that we have, they can't make, by rule of law, they can't make political contributions. This has none of that. Camelot and the people that are the benefactors of our lottery winnings and our lottery profits, they'll be able to make extraordinarily generous campaign contributions to the people who delivered them these wild profits. Now, I'm not trying to sound conspiratorial, because we've seen these kind of movies in the past. We've seen these games in the past. And we know the ending. The ending is, sorry, Granny, profits before you. Sorry, that nursing home that used to have a nurse for every 5 or 10 people, now we need a nurse for every 20. And their wages are going to be suppressed, so you're going to have a constant turnover of people doing that job. And we're going to outsource it and privatize it, do all these things to lower the wages and lower the quality of the work and lower the regulations so that, well, we're no longer caring for people in these senior centers and in these nursing homes. We're warehousing them, holding them for their final days because you know what? Profit was so important. I'm telling you, we need to be outraged about this. We need to be calling our representatives. We need to be losing our minds over this kind of stuff. Because we're getting ripped off again. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Now, I can't get this public policy poll out of my head. 49% of voters, Republican voters, 49% of the GOP voters say that they still say that it was Acorn who stole the election. Now, think about this. I mean, you know, the 2008 election, 52% of Republicans said that Acorn stole the election, even though Acorn has been, well, defunct for what? 6 years now? Gone? Done? It just boggles the mind. And the other part of it just blows my mind. The 8% of the people who support the Leon Panetta, Conrad Burns plan. You know, the 8% of those people, let's go with Panetta. On the other side, the 17% of those who, are in opposition of the Panetta-Burns plan blows the mind. Let's go to D.C. where I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, where do you stand on the Panetta-Burns plan to solve the fiscal mirage?
Well, you know something,
there is no plan. There's no plan.
Right. I mean, all of these plans or non-plans are very skimpy on the details. The two former Treasury secretaries who were Treasury secretaries under President Clinton, Rubin and Summers, came out with a plan. But even their plan, which I like better than some of the other plans, needs to be fleshed out a bit.
Yeah. Well, I got to be honest. Anything that Summers and Rubin come forth with, I've got a question. You know,
I do too, but it's better than what's out there.
Well, it's better than the Boehner, the Romney-Ryan plan. It's better than what the Republicans offered yesterday. And if you looked at it, you know, you go, well, where's this revenue? Where's this $800 billion? And, you know, like I said yesterday, the North Koreans found the mythical unicorn. Well, evidently the Republicans found the revenue fairy, because they're not saying where this $800 billion in quote-unquote new revenue is coming from.
Well, yes, and that's the issue, that no one will say where the new revenue is coming from. And just like, you know, they're now touting, although they didn't tout it initially, the Bowles-Simpson plan, but as Senator Sanders has said, and he's speaking at the press club tomorrow, this Bowles-Simpson commission is ruinous, is that a word, for most older people, most people on disability, and particularly even veterans who they estimate, you know, by the time they're in 65 would lose about $2,000 a year, which is a lot for a veteran.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the thing that bothers me, and, you know, and I've said this before, I understand shared sacrifice. I understand rolling up your sleeves and getting to work, but not the first club out of the bag. I mean, the first club out of the bag should not be going to my grandmother who's living on a fixed income and saying, hey, by the way, you know, we're gonna change how the cost of living adjustments are made, and you're not gonna have enough. And over time, you're gonna slide into poverty. And oh, by the way, you're close to retirement age. We're gonna push that off a little bit longer so that maybe you'd never make it to Medicare and you never make it to Social Security. Kind of like Simpson.
You know, my problem with this pushing it to 69 years old is, what about people? Well, one, who are in physically demanding jobs, but two, how many people do you know over 50 who lose their jobs because they want younger people or people who aren't going to cost them as much money?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of this is, if you're keeping people in the workforce longer, that means you're not opening opportunities for the next generation to come through, and you're not getting that kind of turnover. And to me, that's important. And, you know, as a society, I wish we would change our way of thinking, because I talk to people every day who think that the reason we're on this planet is to work. And me, I think the reason that you work is, well, to live, to enjoy your family and to enjoy, you know, what you can.
Well, you know, in Europe, they say Americans live to work and they work to live.
That's a better way of putting it. But at the end of the day, this pushing off of Social Security and recalculating, or pushing off of Medicare and recalculating Social Security as a first step is the wrong step, in my opinion. We should, at the minimum, be going back to the Clinton tax code. And I would even argue going back to the tax code that Reagan, came into office under, or maybe Kennedy, or even that good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Yeah, you know something, I've been reading, this is off the topic, but a new biography, or it isn't so new, a couple of years ago, on Dwight Eisenhower. He was quite amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and he was a Republican.
Well, not today. Oh, God. He'd be a flaming, he'd be sitting next to Sanders on that far left part of the political spectrum today.
And even Tricky Dick Nixon came up with the EPA.
Yeah, well, and OSHA, don't forget that.
Right.
The job-killing OSHA. But again, these are different times, and I think it's because we're different people. We've been sold and we've been inundated with right-wing corporate blather. We've been brainwashed to believe that anything that the Mitt Romneys of the world and the wealth class want is what's best for us, because, well, they're wealthy, so obviously they know more than we do, and they know how to they're the job creators, right, Ellen?
Right.
But it never seems to work out. I mean, you keep paying to the chair, you keep paying to the chair. I mean, corporate profits have never been better. This third quarter was the highest corporate earnings quarter in the history of this country, since they've been keeping statistics. And you know what is at the other end of that? Wages. Wages have never been lower as a percentage.
And as you know, I don't need to tell you this, the percentage of what a CEO makes. When we were growing up, well, you're younger than me, but when I was growing up, nobody who was a CEO earned more than seven or eight times their lowest paid worker. Well, that's, you know, it's thousands of times sometimes now.
You know, when I'm in the process of writing this book, and one of the stories that I'm putting in this book is a story that my grandfather told me, kind of to highlight this, because, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, we were talking about, you know, the split and how the gulf was happening between the very wealthy and the working class. And he told me the story of how he took my grandmother to see a play. She'd always wanted to go to Hannah to see the plays downtown, wanted to go to a fancy restaurant. So he saved up a little bit of money and he did it. They went to this restaurant, made reservations, and as he was being seated, his boss came in. And of course they had to wait because didn't have reservations. And then took my grandma, they had a wonderful dinner, went over to the play and sat down. There were two empty seats next to them. And as fate would have it, as the play began, the lights went down, in comes his boss and his wife, much to the chagrin of the people sitting in the row. And he said it was at that moment that I realized that, you know, now we've got the ability to kind of be in the same world. We live in the same area, but they don't want us around. They don't want the people who do the work around them. They don't want them in their restaurants or in their playhouses.
Wow, that's quite a story.
I mean, it's just an amazing, one of those moments where you go, this is exactly what's happening. Look where we are. And that was only 30 years ago.
Interesting. That is very interesting.
But, you know, it highlights that fact, you know, because what the right keeps telling us, well, you could go to the same restaurants. They don't want us around. We've got gated communities. You've got private clubs and some of the fees to get into those. Working people are never going to get there. And we have, as John Edwards, for all his faults, as he said, and he was right about, there are two Americas. There's the America that the ultra-wealthy in this country can afford and seclude themselves into, and then what the rest of us have to fight over.
Well, that's right. And if this Republican budget gets its way, it's not going to be hopeful for anybody. And I mean, you wonder, did these people get elected by their local people? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, you look at the gerrymandering that went on into this state, and it happened across the country. I mean, a lot of the states that have Republican legislatures and Republican governors, what you saw were, you know, some magical map drawing, some creative mapping, if you will. Here in Pennsylvania, anyway, they did a masterful job, and the guy who's the head of the Senate here, Pileggi, he wants to go and change the way we allocate electors. So that Romney would have won Pennsylvania.
Oh my gosh.
Well, because he wants to go by congressional district. And so they wanted, it would have been, you know, 13 or 12 votes for Romney and 8 votes for Obama.
So they don't want to do it based on population. They want to do it based on just these areas.
Well, they're going to do it on congressional districts because, you know, in Pennsylvania, while Democrats carried the vast majority of votes and won huge numbers in all statewide races and in the presidential, they did lose. Democrats lost 13 of the 18 congressional seats.
So they want to say, well, if I see what you're saying. Oh, my gosh.
That's
crazy. Is he going to succeed?
Well, no. I mean, that's not just Pennsylvania. That's the movement across the country. That's going to be the next – that's the 2016 plan to steal the election, because understand, if you were to do that in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in some of the other battleground states, Romney wins. By the way that we've allowed redistricting to happen and the way they've drawn these maps in such a creative fashion, instead of talking about, like Iowa does, how can we get competitive races, how can we get the most Republican wins and put those Democrats across each other? Look at California. Look at here in Pennsylvania. Look at some of the stuff that's gone on. I fear 2016 is going to be that. That's going to be the game plan.
Wow. What can I say? It's pretty astounding. And you're right. The thing is that local people have got to get active.
But it comes down to what we're doing right here. People got to know what's happening. You know, they've got to know what's coming. And I'm telling people, watch what's next. I mean, this austerity, I've been talking about for 6-7 years now. Europe's been going through this push for the last several years. We did, up until about a year and a half ago, nobody in the U.S. knew what austerity was. And now we're looking it right in the face, and they're saying, oh, but it's good for us. It's going to save the economy. We're going to pay the debt off. Nonsense. We're going to hand more money to the very wealthy, and they're going to use it against us.
Well, and the point is that there are the ones that are saying, oh, well, you know, we're not going to even pay health insurance anymore in our companies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I also see happening, and I can just hear it in the tone of Washington.
Well, we will see where this goes. I understand Bob Dole was in the Senate today, looking fairly, very frail in a wheelchair. Why was he in the Senate?
Well, he was in the Senate because, The United Nations has an international disabilities treaty, and they're trying to get it ratified in as many countries as they possibly can. Well, the disabilities treaty is modeled after and pretty much very similar to the United States Disabilities Act. And so it was our essential wording modeled on us, and your friend, Pennsylvanian, I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek, Rick Santorum went there with another Congress senator and lobbied against it, saying it would promote abortion. I mean, just crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, look.
And Bob Dole was on the right side of this, as was John McCain.
Well, I mean, Rick Santorum, that's perfect for him because he's got a job at, what is it, World Net Daily, the conspiracy site. So here you go. There's his conspiracy angle. Everything is going to lead to more abortions. I guess that's the writing we're going to see in the future.
I was speechless when I realized what was going on. And there's, you know, frail Bob Dole, who is trying, I mean, he was majority leader. He doesn't even have any sway.
Yeah.
He was a presidential candidate.
You know what the sad thing is, you know, I miss the days of Bob Dole. I miss the days of Richard Nixon. I mean, you know, when the Republicans were at least semi-lucid and semi-rational.
Right, and we thought they were the bad guys.
Yeah.
If we only knew.
Yeah, I mean, this march to the extreme. I'm hoping at some point, I ask my Republican friends, please, a little sanity in your party. Get back involved. Go do something.
And they say their party's too crazy for them to be involved in.
And finally, the governors took to the White House. What did they have to say?
Well, there were three and three. It was a bipartisan group, including Governor Walker of Wisconsin, who, as you know, survived that recall, sort of.
Yeah.
You were there. I wasn't. They basically said they want some control on a state level if they're going to give cuts to the budget and aid to the state, so that the governors have some control over the way this money is spent, and it is not totally controlled by Washington. Well, that makes sense, and that was bipartisan. Other than that, they didn't say a whole lot.
Yeah, and I understand Governor Cuomo was on the Hill yesterday asking
for
aid.
He certainly was. He was asking for $80 billion with a B dollars. And I think he wanted 42 of that for New York State. He was sort of doing everybody's bidding. He met with both Republicans and Democrats. Doubtful they're going to see that money, but
yeah.
Worth a college try.
Yeah, you got to give it a shot. That's why they pay your salary. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Earth, sky.
Today, Snowball Earth. It's a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, Earth was entirely covered by ice.
There's geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists haven't been able to agree on how an ice-covered Earth could have ever thawed out again. So they've never entirely accepted the Snowball Earth theory.
In late 2012, a team of scientists from the U.S., Germany, and France published a paper about how a snowball Earth might have begun to melt. They used a computer model, the same sort of model used to study global warming in our time, to examine the role of clouds above an Earth entirely covered with ice.
In modern studies of climate, clouds play a complex role. They reflect sunlight and so help cool the Earth. And they also trap sunlight and so help warm the Earth. That's why clouds are a challenge in studies of global warming.
But a snowball Earth would have already been highly reflective, so the reflectivity of clouds would be less important, these scientists say. They say clouds' primary role would have been to trap heat and so start melting the ice, thawing the snowball Earth, and leading eventually to the world we know today. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words snowball Earth. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence. Your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It is the holiday season, after all, and what we've seen is Freddie and Fannie have decided that anyone in the eviction process, well, we're going to hold off. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said they will not proceed with foreclosure evictions during the holiday season, starting on December 17th and December 19th, and extending through January 2nd. Nobody's going to be kicked out of their homes. Who are facing evicted, none of them. Now on the third, you better watch out because we're coming for you. But during the holiday season, we're going to make sure that they don't do it. In fact, Bank of America announced that they will also halt foreclosures just during the holiday season. Trust me though, they will be back, because they don't want to look like the Grinch because didn't you know there's a war on Christmas? If you watch Fox News, all you see is, well, the war on Christmas! Those evil people, they don't like religion! And the real war on Christmas, if you really need to know, is not this feigned outrage over people wanting to put up a happy solstice day or Hanukkah symbols or who knows what. It's really global warming. You look at the climate change that's going on, and right now we are in at least a good portion of the country. Right now, 63% of the continental U.S. is experiencing drought conditions. The drought will last probably through the rest of the winter, especially in the Midwest. And, you know, you want to talk about the Grinch, you want to talk about the war on Christmas. Well, the drought has hurt the new growth, these newly planted trees, which take 6 to 12 years to reach full height. So maybe we'll just have miniature Christmas trees from now on. In fact, the Minnesota Star Tribune writes, the dry late summer and fall killed many young trees, perhaps 40%. So, you know, the trees that we get this year, don't worry about. Those are usually 6, 10, 12 years old. Wait a couple of years when there are none, and we have to then pay double. And the reality is, study after study has shown that we're gonna see more of these severe droughts. We're gonna see more of them more often. And the reality is, it's the climate change. And while we may be seeing the worst drought in 50 years, the impact just isn't Christmas, just isn't the Christmas trees. We've got food banks who are struggling because, well, there's not as much coming in. Donations down. So when the conservatives tell you, well, it's the war on Christmas, well, we know the real Grinch. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast, Stitcher. Email rick@ricksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial.